Support for Boston Public Radio comes from M&M Skylights, installing and servicing a wide range of commercial and residential Velux skylight products. You can find more information about their installation process and schedule a consultation at mmskylights.com.
I'm Andrea Cabral. Jim and Marjorie are out today. Ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, the Baker administration put the brakes on a legislative investigation into large-scale failures at the RMV. We're opening the lines and asking you, with seven people dead, does the administration owe it to us to give us answers? Then, Attorney General Maura Healey joins us for her monthly edition of Ask the AG, taking your questions and your calls.
And I'm Sue O'Connell. It's then time for What to Expect When You're Expecting the Mueller Testimony. We're going to talk to legal analyst Michael Zeldin about the Democrats' game plan and if Mueller will give the party the soundbite they have been looking for. And can you believe it? It's been 50 years since Apollo 11. And astronauts, what are they doing? Still drinking Tang. We're going to talk to food writer Corby Kummer about how the meal plan in outer space has advanced by light years and how it hasn't. That's next on BPR.
Boston Public Radio. We are live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. I'm Andrea Cabral here with Sue O'Connell. Jim and Marjorie are mysteriously absent.
People are wondering what we did with them because we are like Batman and Robin.
I hear that they are at some sort of highfalutin event that
we're
is
not.
Being...
We're highfalutin ourselves here at the Boston Public Library.
We are locally highfalutin. I think they are slightly distance away highfalutin, but in any event... And regardless of what we have done for them, and there is no DNA evidence to prove that we've done anything with them,
because
they are not here.
We would leave our phones at home, first of all. If we committed a crime, we would not bring our phones with us.
I tend to wear all plastic, and I cover my feet.
See?
And my, yeah.
There you go.
The Department of Transportation is becoming the third rail for the Baker administration. So on top of the dysfunctional MBTA, we now have the Registry of Motor Vehicles being beleaguered by mismanagement and oversight. This includes their failure to act on notifications from Connecticut that Vladimir Zukowski had been charged with drunken driving in May. Mr. Zukowski remained fully licensed and on the road until last month when he crashed and killed seven motorcyclists. The legislature scheduled a hearing to investigate the RMV's extensive negligence, but it turns out that two registry officials who were called to testify were no-shows. And that's because the Baker administration does not want to make certain witnesses and information available until an independent auditing firm hired by the state completes a 60-day review. We are taking your calls on this, asking, is it unacceptable? The number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Is this the epitome of RMV dysfunction? 877-301-8970. We're taking your calls on all things RMV today, your horror stories. And if you have something nice to say, we'd like to hear that too. Give us a call.
So, you know, the other challenge here, Andrea, is the Baker administration, Governor Charlie Baker's administration, which I feel compelled to say when we're talking about these institutional crises that he didn't invent this problem, right? These are problems, the MBTA, the child care issues, the state care that have been institutional and through a number of governors, probably dating back to Bill Weld, right? So I feel compelled to make sure that it's not all on Governor Baker that these problems are happening. But then again, we have the issue where there's an oversight hearing called, and the administration, as you noted, doesn't send people to show up to testify. And in a state where we are predominantly Democrats for lawmakers, in the House and in the Senate, we've got a Republican in the main office, most popular governor in the United States of America. And so what? Two people don't show up. What's the big deal? We've been seeing this all across the world. It's happening from Hope Hicks to right here in Massachusetts, right?
Right. I mean, and that troubles me deeply that this does appear to be, well, I'm sure that the Baker administration feels that its reasoning for not sending these officials is not is far superior to the essential indifference that's being shown by the Trump administration to Congress. It's still troubling. The bottom line is that the legislature is a separate and co-equal branch of state government. Co-equal meaning that they are entitled to conduct oversight or launch an investigation, however you want to characterize it, and not be dependent on the timeline of the executive branch. So the executive branch, the Baker administration has control over the pace and the length of time that it takes to do this audit, whether or not it is granted an extension. You can't hold the legislative branch hostage to the pacing of your internal audit when they have a separate and independent obligation to look into it. And that's what I think is troubling. The problem for the legislature is they have no subpoena power. So they're not, you can sort of, stiff arm them because they have no mechanism to force registry officials to show up to give testimony. That said, the executive branch should be facilitating that testimony and not stiff-arming.
We're looking for you to join our conversation about the Massachusetts RMV. 877-301-8970 is the number to dial. It seems that over the years, over the many decades, we have solved and then some problems at the RMV and then created new ones. I mean, I think for those of us of a certain age, we can recall how awful the RMV was, and then the front of the house got fixed, you will, that you would show up, you'd get a number, you'd get
that
a
ticket. That was Dan Grabauskas. He was great. He was a great RMV guy.
That was under Deval Patrick?
No, I think he was under the Romney administration.
Romney, right.
He was a holdover for a period of time in the Patrick administration, but he was asked to leave or resigned.
And some are wondering if the fixing of the front of the house contributed to the problems in the back of the house. And also when we live in a world with all of this data where, Disney knows exactly when I'm entering and exiting the park, right? Facebook knows when I'm looking to buy Red Sox tickets. I basically can't go anywhere by a store without, if the app is on, telling me that CVS is having a sale on a product that I use all the time. You have to wonder why we're using envelopes and pieces of paper to keep track of dangerous drivers.
Well, the registry does have a history of antiquity when it comes to the mechanisms used to keep up with our cars, our licenses, and other things. But what I'll say here is, with this issue in particular, even if it was a paper-driven system, this is a simple issue. If you have a system of reciprocity whereby you notify other states when someone has run afoul of your driving laws and has had their license suspended, and similarly, other states notify you when there are infractions in their state that you should be concerned about, particularly given that it's the New England region and we communicate fairly well anyway, there is really no excuse for these to have just piled up other than someone at some point decided that they weren't going to do their job. And that doesn't have anything to do with us, there's no magic to it is what I'm sort of saying. This is a fundamental core part of doing the job at the Registry of Motor Vehicles is finding out where your drivers, how they're doing in other states, and you being mindful of other states wanting to know how their drivers are doing in yours.
877-301-8970 is the number for you to join our conversation. We're going to go to Jack. Jack is calling us. How you doing there, buddy? What do you think about the RMV?
It's just the latest in a string of issues with Charlie Baker. How he maintains 70% approval rate is beyond me. So what happened with the son, with the groping on the JetBlue, nothing, silence. A week after that, a guy was accused of groping somebody on a plane in Salem, a carpenter. He was brought into district court, boom, charged everything. Charlie Baker's son has been free so far. It's been probably almost 2 years.
Well, we would also say, I think, that the prosecutor's office can never confirm or deny if they are continuing to investigate someone. That's right, right, Andrea?
Well, they can, but they often choose not
yeah,
to.
Right, right.
Yes.
But Jack, to the issue of the RMV in particular, I mean, I recently my daughter's going through the learning how to drive process, and there's nothing quite like exposing your pampered and spoiled teenager, your queen, to what it's like to be an adult and have to navigate the process of an RMV in the last day of the month. May 31st, when people are getting their licenses and going to college. It does seem like we should be able to expect better on both the front end and in a way to prevent the type of deadly errors that apparently happened recently, right? Jack?
Yeah, you would think so, yeah. But, I mean, the state police is a debauchery, too. I mean, if then you have the MBTA on top of it, he's not going to be able to handle the RMV.
All right, Jack. Appreciate you calling in. Thanks so much. We're going to go to John. John is calling us. John, what's your experience with the RMV?
I would just like to say that I think you're feeding into the political drama of it all. There's a 60-day process. Let it be. Why create more divisiveness? It's unfortunate. Someone erred, but let it play out and stay away from the drama.
So, well, John, these are boxes and boxes of these. It wasn't just a simple error by one person. What they've even found in their preliminary investigation is that there is a backlog of boxes and boxes and boxes of these notifications, many of which, or most of which, are unopened.
And I would make the point that if I were the public relations person, if I were the public relations person, I would say to the administration, send the people to the hearing and say exactly, you know, what you're saying. Say we have a 60-day investigation going on. Don't just not show up. I mean, that's sort of a slap in the face. That makes it political when you don't show up, no?
No, the political hearing is more of a political show. Basically, there's a process in place, and there's error and needs to be correction. It's extremely unacceptable what happened. And so the people should be held accountable, but, you know, let it lie as it may.
You have confidence that the audit would be done effectively and that corrections would be made efficiently?
Correct.
Well, John, let me ask you this. So what you're saying is that the legislature has no role in the oversight of anything that the executive...
I did not say that whatsoever.
Okay.
No, that's what you said.
No.
I said the legislature is playing into the political divisiveness of it all.
See, but this is always...
You know, there's a process in place, and why create drama when it's not necessary?
No. So, John, what I'm asking you, the reason why I asked it that way is so that you could tell me whether or not I was mistaken. So you do say that the legislative branch has an oversight role. Their oversight role is independent. They get to exercise it. If you agree that that's true, you have to agree that they get to exercise it in a timely manner and not on the executive branch's timetable, which seems to me is exactly what they're doing with these hearings.
I would indicate that the legislative branch can focus on other legislative, more pressing issues and let the RMV play out in the 60 days and then find, you know, let that due process unfold and let there be a conclusion and let there be correction and the legislative process not get, you know, that's when the Republicans, Democrats, whatever, start creating drama and that's when people turn off.
Well, there are a few things more dramatic than seven people losing their lives on the road at the hands of someone allegedly.
And 1,607 people with suspended licenses that are still driving.
Right. I mean, right. Both of those things, right? Those things are fairly dramatic things, and I think that's what gets people's attention. But
all right, John,
thank you for your call.
Thanks for calling in. We're taking your calls. We're talking about the RMV at 877-301-8970. We're going to go to Mark. What's happening, Mark?
Hello?
Hello, Mark. You're on the air.
It's actually Mike. Mike from Riviera.
Oh, I'm sorry.
They had your name wrong. I'm sorry.
Welcome, Mike.
It's okay. First of all, I think you folks are doing a great job. Jim and Marjorie have big shoes to fill.
Thanks.
My observation is, first of all, the legislature does have oversight over the executive branch because they have the power of the purse. And if the RMV doesn't want to cooperate with sending people to hearings, that should be reflective in when the budget process comes around.
Right. That's exactly why they're given that the separation of responsibility is the ones that control the purse. Even though they're separate and co-equal branches of government, they are responsible for the funding. To your point.
And the other thing is, now if Massachusetts is not handling information that they're receiving from other states. You know, I'd like to look at see if they're also sending out information, sending out to these other states when citizens from other states are involved in incidents in Massachusetts.
Yeah, my understanding is there's also this database issue where the states put information into a database, and apparently states have to go into the database to extract the information that they need rather than having a push that, you know, a driver in your state has been entered into this database. I mean, to me, this is what drives me crazy about being here in the hub of technology in Massachusetts, where we are designing all of these great applications for things to do, and a simple push notice for the national databases doesn't seem to exist. Mike, Michael, right? Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. I mean, it's astonishing. This breaking news that just came in, right?
There is. Actually, apparently, the AG, who's going to be with us in just a few minutes, she's actually investigating Westfield Transport, which is the company that employed this 23-year-old West Springfield truck driver, Zukowski, who was charged with killing the seven bikers in New Hampshire. It certainly has been alluded to in some of the previous press coverage, the print coverage, that there was a sort of a history of infractions not being addressed by Westfield Transport. So apparently the AG's on that.
All right. We're going to go back to your calls. We're talking to you, 877-301-8970. Paul is calling us. Paul, thank you for calling into Boston Public Radio.
Hello?
Hi.
Hello? Hi, how are you?
Good. What's going on?
Well, I was at the registry yesterday. I'm a truck driver, so I had to get my medical card recertified. We're not even supposed to. Technically, they did all this so we wouldn't have to carry our medical cards, and we still have to. And it took just to scan a paper. I sat there for an hour. And then on top of that, you know, the real ID thing, I had to go back to anybody prior to 2010 has to get a brand new birth certificate. Your birth certificate that you got when you were born is not good enough to get your real ID.
Right. We have a lot of folks at NBC Boston who join us, you know, to work, and they come from other cities, big cities like Chicago and Philadelphia, and they go, oh, I'm going to go do my lunch break to the RMV and change my license. We go, no, you have to take a personal day. I mean, that's like the whole other level, that you have to take a personal day to do anything at the RMV. All right.
Thank you so much for your call, Paul.
Ay, ay, ay.
We're talking about the RMV, and the conversation is going to continue on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. This is Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. I'm Andrea Cabral. I am here with Sue O'Connell, and Jim and Marjorie are out today. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about all things Registry of Motor Vehicles at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. We're talking about both the problems with the Registry of Motor Vehicles, your particular experiences, and the fact that two registry officials failed to show up at a legislative hearing that's providing oversight into the problems that the registry just didn't show up yesterday.
Yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, this feels like that trickle down theory, right? Where if the president's administration doesn't need to show up for the Senate, then why would Charlie Baker's administration need to just show? Why not just show up and say over and over again, it's a 60-day process. We're here out of respect. We're showing up out of respect because you're a co-equal branch of government. It's a 60-day process. The audit will be back when we have more information. Is that so? Why would you not do that?
Well, I can see on the one hand, maybe that would at least have been the polite or courteous way to do it. But if I were a legislator, what I would say is I understand that you have an internal process. We have a separate role as the legislature, and we are going to ask you questions about this. The truth shouldn't change. So we understand that you'll be giving the truth from your perspective, from based on what you know, and that later on in an investigation there may be facts that you didn't know at the time or didn't consider. But these two registry officials, one of them is the head of the, I think, the Merit Rating Board, and the other is the head of the driver control unit. And I'm sure that among the questions the legislature wanted to ask were general questions about how those two divisions of the agency work, what the rules are, and what generally happens when they're not followed. There are lots of questions that they could have asked that would have been enlightening to the public that these people could have and should have, in my view, answered.
We're looking for your input here, 877-301-8970. We're going to go to Paula. Paula, thank you for calling into Boston Public Radio. What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I think I wanted to agree with the second caller that I think you have to give the RMV time to go through its process, go through its review. I think if they were to show up at the committee, they wouldn't have all the answers for the committee members.
But what Andrea just said is that the truth doesn't change. I mean, that's sort of, I'm going to make that a T-shirt and take all the profits from it, if you don't mind, Andrea. But you know, if you know, at my job, if I got called in and was asked, well, when you write the script, what happens to the script after you write it? Whether or not I was under investigation or being asked for my manager, my truth would be the same regardless of what the outcome of an investigation was, right?
No, I agree that the truth is there. I think my feeling is that the RMV may not have all of the answers, and I think that they would probably just be embarrassed if they would be asked questions. Well, how is this process working? How is that process working? And, you know, I don't know if we would get all the answers from this, from the committee hearing.
But are you okay with any administration officials not showing up when lawmakers ask them to? I mean, to me, this is like becoming an epidemic in our country.
Yes. Yeah. You know what? Probably the proper thing would have been, you know, notify the committee that they weren't able to show up, but say that we will answer questions once the audit is complete.
Okay.
I understand your point. I mean, it's well taken, Paula. I think I'm a little bit sensitive to it because I know, having been Secretary of Public Safety for the last 2 years of the Patrick administration, I do know that there is some information, sometimes a lot of information, depending on the issue, that is immediately available, that is not going to change over the course of an audit. And so, you know, I mean, you know, it's not that an audit shouldn't be done. It's not that there shouldn't be internal processes. But I worry about things like this when we used to have this issue routinely when something happens that's potentially criminal and a law enforcement person is involved. Historically, they will hold internal investigation and discipline in abeyance until that criminal process is done. That can take years sometimes. I know they said that this is a 60-day audit, but that can take years sometimes. And what you end up with sometimes are people who are never held to account internally because so much time has passed waiting for an external investigation.
Right, they retire or they resign or they move
People's
on.
People's memories fade.
And the problem doesn't get fixed, which I think, as much as we want to hold people accountable, again, I'm old enough to have been through this rodeo with the RMV over and over again, and here we are, you know, saying it's okay that people are not testifying about what actually is happening until an audit happens, so then it reeks of me as a Revere girl as we're going to wait till we get our story straight. Until we see what happens at the audit.
Well,
Paula,
and I will say,
thanks for calling in.
The fact that they've been able to put a definitive 60-day timeline on this audit, assuming that they didn't ask for an extension for any reason, I think goes to how discreet the amount of information is that they need to gather.
Right.
And I think they could probably do it in a shorter period of time and show up to the hearing. But,
all right.
But I understand your point, Paula. Thank you for your call.
All right, we're going to go to Laura, who's calling us from Somerville. Laura, welcome to the show. What's on your mind? Hello, Laura?
Laura, are you there?
Oh, I think we're going to go to Carolyn. I'm sorry.
Okay, let's try Carolyn.
Hi, Carolyn.
I'm here.
Carolyn?
Wait, this is Laura here.
Oh, is that... have Laura. We thought
Laura.
We lost you.
We got you, Laura. Hey, what's going on?
It's listening on the radio at the same time, and you're not in sync. It's very strange.
Yeah, it freaks you out. You should see how we feel.
So what's your question, Laura?
Turn off your radio. Oh. I've always wanted to say that. Make sure you turn your radio down.
Okay, I did.
Good.
Okay, so... I've been either a clerk or a warden at a polling place in Somerville for the last dozen years.
Well, thank you for your service. I sincerely mean that. Thank you.
It's actually fun. It's actually really, really interesting just to see all the people come through. But the reason I'm calling is because I have any number of people come through who say, you know, who aren't on the books, but they're not registered. And I say, you know, where did you register? And they say, at the RMV. And I said, did you mark off the box on the RMV? And they say, yes, we specifically marked off the box that we're registered, and they are not on the books. And then I can't let them vote.
You know, and this, as I said, my daughter's going through the driving permit process and getting the license. I am amazed at how much activity the user has to have in response to the institution. So, for example, we paid the fee for her to take the driver's test in September, And we're not really sure if we paid or not because we didn't necessarily get a response email immediately. Right. So I had to go to my bank account or my credit card to see if the payment went through. And there's no reason for why you have to be so active to confirm whether you are registered to vote or whether you've made the payment. I mean, it's right. a full systems problem.
Well, I think in beyond all of this, because there are Laura described is her experience in checking off a box and not getting the follow-through on that, whether it's the problem with this particular truck driver and his license not being suspended, or whether it's just the time that it takes to do things. If nothing else, I would hope that this audit would find that regular auditing of agencies that deal with the public
yes.
like this is necessary, because if boxes and boxes of something can accumulate with no one doing that job and no one noticing, that speaks more to the need for intermittent enforcement and oversight that's just not happening.
Is that something that Auditor Suzanne Bump can do? Does that fall under? Because I know that when people run for auditor, some fresh faces usually say, I want to audit everything. I want
right.
to look at everything. Would that fall
under
her
purview?
I think
the IG's office can audit. They tend to audit specifically for an issue that is raised. The Inspector General also performs some of this function. But if you're going to say now that you're in the midst of conducting an internal audit that is keeping you from a legislative branch hearing, then I would hope that one of the findings is that we will regularly do these internal audits. We can catch problems early, and so that we will never get to this point again. That should be
it seems
certainly
like something
a finding.
You should do regularly.
Right.
I mean, nonprofits are required to do audits right. in order to keep their nonprofits.
And very
status.
Few government agencies, I know this from experience, very few do that. But the RMV is one of the ones where the rubber meets the road in terms of people having interaction with a government agency.
All right, Laura, thanks so much for your service at the polls, and thanks for your reporting.
Thank you, Laura.
We're going to go to Carolyn in Worcester now. Carolyn, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Hi. I just have a side almost. I worked for the Commission Against Discrimination as an investigator for a long while, and I had trucking cases, commercial truckers who came in to file discrimination cases. And you always do an investigation, get the comparators to see how bad that person was as opposed to the truckers that remained. I was appalled. No one had a good record. I'm going, why are any of these people on the road?
Yeah.
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 It was horrible. Drunk driving, speeding, crashes. I mean, what are they? They pick them based on how bad they are, and they're on the road, meaning the R&B is allowing this.
As in the company. I mean, and that's one of the things we're getting ready to talk to A.G. Healy about, because she's actually investigating Westfield Transport, apparently, which is the company that employed this particular driver, and I'm sure a number of others. But we'll get. I'm glad you called, and I'm glad you raised the issue, because we'll get into that a little bit with her about the obligation of the company beyond the obligation of the agency, the obligation of the company to keep these people off the road.
All right, Carolyn, thanks so much for calling in, and thanks to our callers that we didn't get a chance to. We appreciate your being on hold. Coming up, Attorney General Maura Healey is here for Ask the AG. We're taking your questions and your calls. She's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio. We are live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. We are joined right now by Attorney General Maura Healey. She is here for Ask the Attorney General, taking our questions and yours. You can tweet the AG at Boss Public Radio, send an email to BPR at WGBH.org, or call 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Attorney General Healey, welcome back. It is, as always, great to have you here.
Hey, great to be here.
All right, so the first question is that we've already been referred to as Batman and Robin. So if this
who would you be?
Well, she's Batman,
I'm Commissioner
obviously.
Gordon.
You can be Batman if you want. All right, so we were just talking about the RMV, and breaking news came in while we were taking calls that your office is investigating Westfield Transport. This is the company that employed the person who was allegedly charged in the role of the tragic crash in New Hampshire. What's happening? Can you give us an update on that?
Well, I can confirm, Sue, that my office has opened a criminal investigation into Westfield Transport for its role in this absolutely devastating, horrifying, and tragic incident in New Hampshire. I can't say much more than that, given that it's an active criminal investigation, but this is absolutely something that I view as imperative and important.
We just had a caller that she apparently was in a position to see what the driving histories were of a number of truck drivers, and she was appalled. It expressed her...
That they were acceptable. The terrible histories, OUIs.
And so she kind of raised the question, and it's sort of an interesting one, and I know it without asking you to comment on the particulars of the investigation, what generally is the obligation of a company? Now, the registry has the frontline obligation to suspend a license or permanently or temporarily based on the offenses that it knows, but do you have a sense generally of how these companies monitor or whether or not they monitor for their drivers?
You know, that's something that we are looking at, that I want to learn more about and that I want to get answers to. What happened here is outrageous. It should not happen. The RMV is absolutely the front line of defense, and it's clear there were all sorts of deficiencies there that require further review and investigation. That's a real problem, and that needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed right now. With respect to this industry and what's happening across the industry, I think and expect that we'll learn more through our investigation. And if there are reforms, if there's action that needs to be taken, of course I'm going to take it and work with others to address this. You know, we are on the roads every single day, and we need to do everything we can to ensure the safety of folks on the road. It's very simple to me, and I think most people are really dumbstruck about, you know, what happened here and how could this possibly be allowed to happen?
Right. The public and what are the internal answers. Processes? If you don't have, you don't make your employees affirmatively obligated to report to you when they have an interaction with law enforcement related to their driving,
right?
And you don't have an internal mechanism for regularly getting that information from the Registry of Motor Vehicles, then you have nothing. Now, they may say, yes, we do, but we just never get anything back. I guess that's part of what your investigation is going to be about.
Well, you know, I'm not going to comment on the entire scope. We're going to see where it goes. But I'll tell you, you know, real concerns about how people come to have licenses in the first place, what sort of review is conducted, what sort of information is available. And this gets to what and what not our RMV has been doing for the last few years with respect to licenses generally, certainly commercial driver's licenses. But I think we know, and each day we learn more, it goes far beyond that. Again, this is a matter of urgency, it's public safety, it's transparency, and I am really frustrated by what I am seeing and hearing with regard to this issue. Much more needs to happen, and it needs to happen now.
What do you think of the fact that the head of, I think it's the Merit Rating Board and the Driver Control Unit, Thomas Bose and I think Keith Constantino, the two officials, didn't show up yesterday to a legislative hearing. I know they don't have subpoena power, but what do you think about that?
Can you imagine yourself not showing up to a hearing? If you were called to a hearing, can you imagine yourself just saying, I'm not going to show up?
No, the public deserves to know. And certainly legislatures charged with the duty of looking at and having oversight over matters deserves answers. And certainly I would expect my people to show up, and I would make sure that they show up, and I would make sure that we are providing answers to the public and to legislatures or whoever is asking in a timely manner. It doesn't mean that you can't continue with what should be a necessary internal investigation. That's an obvious thing that needs to happen. But that can happen separate and apart from answering and providing immediate information right now, because again, it's about the safety of our roads and what's happening out there. The public deserves answers, they deserve action, and they deserve full transparency here.
Okay, so we'll leave the registry, probably albeit briefly, and move on to another subject. I don't know if either of you saw, I just happened to watch it myself, the HBO documentary called I Love You Now Die, which is essentially about the Michelle Carter case and the suicide of Conrad Roy. And it actually, I thought, was a very well done documentary. And it very comprehensive. So there's a story in WGBH News talking, sort of expressing the idea that what they will now call Conrad's Law would criminalize what they're calling suicidal coercion. For the very few people out there that don't know, Conrad Roy had talked about committing suicide for a very long period of time. He had an internet relationship with Michelle Carter. They had actually never met in person. But he finally got to the point where he was, he had decided he was going to kill himself. He was going to do it by remaining in his truck and asphyxiating himself on carbon monoxide fumes. He seemed to change his mind based on the text exchanges, at which point she told him to get back into the car, and he did get back into the car, and he effectuated the suicide. Mm-hmm. She was found guilty, and she was sentenced to prison for her role in that. What do you think of this, first of the idea of Conrad's Law, and second about criminalizing suicidal, what they're calling suicidal coercion?
Yeah, well, I mean, my heart goes out to the Roy family. What a terrible thing. And, you know, it's just heartbreaking, and it's heartbreaking all around. You know, to me, it raises the issue of behavioral health, mental health. What mm-hmm. are we doing? What are we not doing around this state when it comes to making services available? I've worked really hard and have been really loud about the need to provide far greater services for behavioral health, mental health, especially for young people. You know, I'm spending a lot of time, Andrea, in schools these days, and some of it's related to substance use disorder and the education we're trying to do around vaping and the opioid crisis, right, and bullying and teen dating violence and sexual assault, right? We've got a lot of programming out of my office. I'm in schools a lot, and mm-hmm. my team is in schools a lot. But what I hear back so often from school nurses, administrators, teachers, coaches, and young people themselves, they need help dealing with issues of anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation. Right. Those numbers have gone up, as you know.
Way
I mean,
up.
The numbers on young people
and
it's not just, you know, kids who have traditionally been viewed as particularly vulnerable, LGBTQ students. It's across the board,
yeah,
right? So it's just, to me, what this does is really underscore, and I think some of what that documentary that shows too is the mental health issues on both sides of this, right?
Right. I was surprised by how much they went into both sides of it.
Yeah.
It was true. Yeah.
But this is also
and so
an emerging...
what are you doing about that?
Right.
And I just think the more resources, the more we can be there, especially
right.
for young people, that's what we got to do.
This is sort of an emerging idea in law enforcement as well, not just with the opioids, but with our local violence crisis, that we need to stop looking
right.
at the people shooting as not needing help as well as the families of the victims.
Yeah.
Like there's a that crime and behavior that hurts other doesn't happen in this pillar. It happens across the boards, and if we can get services to people who are in crisis, then maybe crimes won't happen as often.
I think it's a great point, Sue, and I know your dad was a police officer, and certainly Andrew, you know
a
lot about public safety. I mean, trauma begets trauma, violence begets violence.
Right.
There are cycles of violence, cycles of trauma that, you know, end up, you spend time, you know, whether, you know, recently I was at the Peace Institute, and, you know, there are mothers there who have had both, you know, children they've lost to gun violence and children who are in jail right now for gun-related crimes. And it is an issue that we need to deal with more holistically. Obviously, we need to do everything we can from a law enforcement perspective and track guns and prosecute those and make sure that we're investigating those crimes and respecting the rights of victims to have answers. But I do believe fundamentally that unless we deal with the underlying causes, the roots of some of what we see when it comes to gun violence, what feeds that, we're not going to be where we need to be. And I think that, you know, that is increasingly a view of law enforcement, and I think that's a really good thing.
I want to talk about some of the tours that you're on. You're on a jobs tour, right? You are out talking about healthy summer youth jobs as part of your role in order to talk to state organizations that are getting grant funding. What are you doing? What you're looking? You kind of have a headhunting job.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not looking for a job. This is for young people. And for 5 years now, I think we've been able to do something really cool, which is to fund jobs around the state for young people. And we do this using some settlement money. We funded over 100 organizations.
Where does the settlement money come from? Because I think sometimes when people hear that there's been a settlement, they that just goes in the back burner.
Okay, well, you know, part of what we do, Sue, every day is we're out there investigating, taking action against companies.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, you know, some of these cases go to trial. Mm-hmm. Some of these cases settle.
And so they
pay over money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've been allowed to keep some of that money, if we apply it towards, for example, it's a health case, healthcare case, we can apply it towards, in this instance, healthy summer youth jobs. And, you know, here's what we've been doing. We've been funding jobs, as they say, over the last 5 years around the state for young people. They're camp counselors. They're coaching sports. They're cooking and nutrition instructors.
I love peer advisors.
Yeah,
they're urban farmers. And so I get to, this is one of the fun parts of the summer, I get to go around and visit some of the job sites and see, you know, young people in action. So this week I'm going up to Lowell to visit Mill City Groves. I'll be at Campfire North in Salem. I'll be down at the South Shore YMCA in Quincy, and I'll be down in New Bedford at the Community Boating Center. And again, these are just examples of some of the more than 800 jobs that we've funded. This is about getting young people working, teaching discipline, teaching responsibility, teaching teamwork, giving them constructive things to do in the summer, and I just love it.
I would note that what's interesting to me is usually there's not enough money to cover the waterfront. There are jobs available in every single county in Massachusetts. That's 14 counties in Massachusetts, and it's really hard to do that and to do it well. So when I, you know, I read both the breadth and the depth of the jobs and the geographical expanse. It really is. You're to be commended for doing it.
Well, thank you. And you know what? It's my team who's to be commended, because my grants program director and other folks within the office spent a lot of time looking at those things. We are a statewide office. We've got to be in all counties. We've got to be in as many places as possible. And so they spent a lot of time, very intentional, figuring out how we can make the most and spread the wealth and find opportunities for kids across the state.
We're going to take your calls at 877-301-8970. It's Ask the AG. Go ahead and give us a call. And we're going to go to Paul, who's calling us from Worcester. Hello, Paul. What's
Hi,
your
Paul.
Question for the Attorney General?
Hello, ladies. It's so calm and chill over there. It's just really
We're yelling at each other during the break. Don't worry about it.
Is it not in Worcester, Paul?
Well, I'm talking about it on the radio. So I recently bought a Dell computer. I've been asking for an itemized invoice so I could verify each option cost. First, they said they can't do that, and I asked them how they could charge me anything if they don't know what it costs. And then they replied, they don't do that. And I've been emailing them all day on this and all week, actually. I've talked to a dozen people. Aren't there laws that they have to provide that if I ask for it?
Yeah, and here's what I'd suggest, Paul. If you want to hang on the line, we'll get you connected with our consumer hotline and the folks there who can pick up the phone and work directly on your behalf with Dell and get you what you need. And for the public, if you run into consumer issues like that, please feel free to send us an email. You can also reach us via Twitter or Facebook, but also just pick up the phone and call 617-727-8400.
I have found in my experience as a consumer that when I think something isn't right, it usually isn't right, right?
Yeah.
So if you ask for something that you think you're entitled to, your gut is probably right on these things. And, you know, my whole life, my mother did nothing but call the Attorney General's office, and she was often right about things. So,
and you know what?
Paul.
We also so find if it's happening to one person, it's probably happening to a bunch of other people. And, you know, that's oftentimes what leads us to launch investigations and take action. So I always encourage people to call. It's how we both help the public, but it's also how we know who the bad actors are out there.
And Paul, and everybody out there, two things. Be persistent and document every single time you call. Write down who said what you said to them, what they said to you, because it's really helpful when you call the AG's office if you can give them a rundown.
877-301-8970. We're going to talk to Mark in Falmouth. Hey, Mark, thanks for calling in. What's your question for Attorney General Healy?
My question is, the Registry of Motor Vehicles just refused to appear in front of a legislative committee. There's no way to compel them to appear. Why not simply pass a law requiring state departments to appear when requested?
Well, Mark, I'm not sure about that premise entirely. I will say this. I don't think that's right to hide behind an internal investigation and not show up. And I don't think you get to decide when it's convenient to testify or who it's convenient to offer up for testimony. I think I've been clear on this. This is a matter that requires transparency, information, and I guess if it were up to me, I would be in the business of providing as much real-time information as possible as we go along, understanding that, there's stuff that you're going to learn that you don't know yet, there's more you're going to look into that you don't know yet, but I mean, this to me seems like real-time information. The sooner the better. Learn as we go. Doesn't mean the internal investigation can't proceed. But, you know, we work in public office. And, you know, it's one of the obligations we have is we owe it to the public. And, you know, when things go bad, when things go you got to show up.
Does this make it hard for law enforcement and for law and order when you've got, not just here in Massachusetts, but up more on the national stage, when you've got people just refusing and ignoring subpoenas? I mean, I can't...
No, there's no... That's the point, is that they don't have a subpoena power at the state level.
But in the national level, if you're just saying, I'm not going to show up, I mean, what does that mean for law and order across the country if you're involved in a civil case or a criminal case and people in power are just saying, I'm not going to show up.
Don't get me started on my impeachment hearing finished by now.
And I'll say this, and it is with the caveat that I am not equating the two. But if you want to talk about what's happened nationally, the fact that people are refusing to testify, the fact that people are refusing to produce records and information, this goes to the undermining and the evisceration of the rule of law and basic principles that should abide in this country. It's wrong. Unfortunately, we've seen the normalization of that over the last 2 years. And hopefully that will be addressed, you know, with new leadership in place next year. But, you know, I just think it's important that there be transparency on this particular issue. And as a matter of public safety, I mean, I don't understand why there's a law passed here that requires notification to police chiefs about, you know, who's had their license suspended, why that isn't happening. You know, laws passed, figure out a way to implement, get the bodies in place to implement,
it's passive.
And get it done. Because it's about public safety. And I mean, God forbid that, you know, you end up in an accident involving somebody who had their license suspended and there should have been a notification there.
It just drives me crazy because I can't, like, buy tickets at Ticketmaster. You know, if there's a limit on how many tickets you can buy, they know it's me trying to buy more tickets. I can't, you know, sneak back into Disney unless I use my why don't we just put Ticketmaster and Disney in charge of all of this and they can make sure that the licenses... never mind, that's a bad idea.
That is a bad idea.
Let's go to
Roger in Marblehead. Roger, what's your comment or your question for the Attorney General?
Hi, I wanted to ask the Attorney General to put herself into Bob Mueller's shoes. And I'm assuming that you've read the Mueller report in detail, and obviously you see what this president does on a daily basis. And I'm just curious, based on your preponderance of the evidence, where you would come down if you were in his shoes, based on what you've read, and whether you think he should be either indicted or impeached or nothing should happen at all. Curious as to what you feel about it.
Yeah, well, I'm, for the record, about a 7.5 women, so I've got a lot of room there to fill if I were to be in Bob Mueller's shoes. But, I mean, here's what I'd say about it, Roger. It's a really thorough and comprehensive report. They clearly did their homework and did their work. It's laid out there. But I think what's unfortunate about what's happened and the way this was ultimately rolled out is that I would have liked to have seen a couple of things. One, the recognition that the landscape has changed, that nobody is playing by normal rules. Perhaps Bob Mueller did not expect the U.S. Attorney General to get up and stage this press conference and actually lie about the contents of the report. That happened. But I think that what should have happened here is there should have been a tighter, more digestible executive summary that was out there, that they should have been proactive with their own press conference and laying out what happened here, and that it shouldn't have been so lawyerly and legalese in terms of some of the descriptions, because, you know, that allowed pundits and others, and certainly Donald Trump, to denigrate and dismiss what was actually contained in the report. So it should have been, like, straightforward. And basically, I would have liked him to say, look, we did our investigation. We did our work here. Here's everything we found. We could have charged obstruction of justice, but I view legal guidance as precluding me from bringing those charges. I am now handing it off to Congress, and Congress has the prerogative and authority to bring those charges.
It could have been that simple.
Yeah, it could
have been
that simple.
Like, and that simple. I just wish that had happened. And, you know, I hope, obviously, the document will stand the test of time.
I'm not
knows,
sure his testimony knows. Will. That's what I'm
we'll
worried
see.
About.
Well,
I hope that this is an opportunity for some level setting and for really making clear the record on this. But I just think as a matter of where we are right now. And it's unfortunate. You know, it's not like the old days where you could, like, come out with something, do your job, ship it to Congress, expect them to do their work, right? We're just in it. Unfortunately, it's a different world these days, and you got to be able to be ready to play on that playing field.
Thanks for your call, Roger, reminding folks they can listen to the Mueller testimony.
And yes,
tomorrow.
Roger, for the record, I think it's pretty unequivocal that there were any number of charges that could have been brought.
Thanks for calling, Roger. We're going to go to Kelly calling from Auburn. Kelly, thanks. What's your question for Attorney General Moore Healy?
Well, whoever intercepted the phone call, I guess. I think it's more of a comment. I mean, I am an independent voter. I'm a single mother of three children. And in fact, my comment is, it's not, I don't think, speaking nationally from the president down. I mean, as far as my own state that I live in, Massachusetts, like, why is it that these high departments, Department of Ed, Department of, you know, Motor Vehicles, all these places cannot follow through with any of their top dogs, have to pass the message to the people? I myself am fighting with the a school system, as usual, about my son's independent ed plan, which is not, doesn't get followed. So I have to go and hire an advocate to speak on behalf of my son, because they basically get the paper signed for the Department of Ed, and the school systems, they don't follow them. So I'm stuck with the $150 an hour advocate. It's just not fair to the everyday. And I feel like I'm self-employed. I've been a small business owner for 36 years and or so, at least 25 of those years. Mm-hmm. And it just is unfortunate that nothing gets followed through.
So, Kelly, if I will, so Attorney General, I've been in this position myself with, getting a program in place and then having to follow it up. We're going to take a break and come back and get your answer on this. Kelly, stay on the line. You're listening to Boston Public Radio. We're with Attorney General Moore Healy. We'll be back after a break.
I'm Andrea Cabral. Jim and Marjorie are out today. Ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, another federal court is challenging Obamacare. At noon, we talk to Attorney General Maura Healey about how she's defending it and why this is so much more than a fight about the laws. It's a fight about whether we as a country are going to take care of one another. She joins us for that, and she'll be taking your calls on this month's edition of Ask the AG.
I'm Sue O'Connell. A New York Times reporter went undercover to experience the frantic life of a cab-dodging, tip-chasing food delivery man. We're going to talk to food writer Corby Kummer about the importance of seeing the food industry through the eyes of the workforce and other headlines about food policy and food culture. Then CNN's John King will join us for a preview of Mueller's public testimony. That's next on BPR.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
This is Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you are just tuning in, Attorney General Maura Healey is here for Ask the AG. You can tweet her at Boss Public Radio, send an email to bpr@wgbh.org, or call us at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970.
So we left with a question from Kelly from Auburn, and this is an experience that a lot of folks have when they're interacting with state agencies, whether it be education or transportation. And I'm going to kind of bottom line it. As consumers, they're unhappy with the way things are going. Is that the domain of the Attorney General's office? Is there something that the Attorney General's office can do to facilitate or help folks who are having issues like that?
Yeah, you know, we don't have control over those agencies. That said, if people are having issues, they feel free to call my office, you know, and we'll do our best to facilitate and try to help out.
Because I had an issue once where I wasn't sure if it was an issue for your office, and I just cold called in, and the person answering the phone was very helpful and gave me departments. So you can act as a resource in some ways.
Yeah, that's right.
So
sometimes, like, look, if there's an issue, we can also give them numbers and places to call to if it's the Office of Child Advocate, for example, if it's related to a child issue. The caller was alluding to something along those lines. So, yeah, we'll try to be a resource and do what we can.
I want to ask about a couple of stories that have been in the news and have been going on. You know, this issue's with the chemists and the cover-up with Sonia Farak and Annie Dugan. Is your office doing everything it can and within your power to make sure that folks who may have been that are serving time or have served their time and maybe their cases deserve a second look because of the bad actions of these state chemists? Is your office doing everything it can to help those people?
You know, I think so, Sue. And this has been a top priority for me in the office since 2015, really, when this came to light. Annie Dugan and Sonia Farak's crimes were egregious. They had such pernicious ripple effects that we continue to see to this day. But what I did and what our office did was to immediately get on board with trying to organize and facilitate conversations and review by DAs, defense counsel, and other stakeholders that resulted actually in the dismissal of the vast majority of cases. So the vast majority of these cases
are already
dismissed. We have an ongoing issue about fines and fees and trying to get fines and fees now paid back to those defendants. That's an ongoing effort and ongoing work. I also think it was important, too, that we as an office do a few things in terms of setting the standard for things, training for prosecutors, participation in a conviction integrity unit and the like, and continuing to work with other groups out there and stakeholders on how we can together identify and implement preventative policies and trainings and other measures.
So in the midst of all of this, I mean, ultimately the focus rightfully, I think, has been on the people who are still trying to get their cases dismissed or people who might possibly still remain in custody. What have you seen in terms of preventative measures to see that this doesn't happen again? And I think, you know, people, I can remember when I was a prosecutor, we didn't even think about it. The certified copy of the chemist's report was the courts took judicial notice of it. If you got it back, you didn't question any of the information that was behind it. And I'm just wondering, because it hadn't happened by the time I left government, whether or not there is more oversight over the chemists, more training that's required, sort of that intermittent auditing to make sure that you don't. Because when you look back at particularly Sonia Farak and you think, if a person were addicted to drugs, this would really be a good job because you could literally take drugs no one was looking for.
It's like, why do people rob banks? Because that's where the money is, right?
Right, but also to your ability to cover it up. I mean, it was in some respects brilliant to be able to take drugs that had already gone through the system that were scheduled for destruction. No one is looking for those. No one's going to pull those for an ongoing trial. And if you substitute something that's fake and what's fake is being destroyed, no one's going to know that. And I'm wondering if you're aware of anything that's happened since then to kind of make sure that this doesn't happen again.
I think a lot has happened, starting with the state police taking over the lab, which had been controlled by the Department of Public Health, implementation of measures and standards that were accredited. That was also something different, and I think there's been a lot of training and implementation of new procedures and policies. And I think, you know, it really underscores, though, you know, that fundamentally this is a matter of fairness and due process for all involved,
right?
For victims, defendants, for prosecutors' offices, which, by the way, is a lot of work to have to go back and redo
right.
And re-examine things. judges, probation. The whole system suffered as a result, and certainly those accused of and convicted of, or those who pled guilty to crimes where there was underlying deficiency, constitutional deficiency with the process, that's a real problem. To me, it just underscores the work that we need to do and the efforts that we need to undertake, and I certainly will support all efforts to undertake the integrity of our system because people depend on this, and ultimately, we're not going to see justice, and a justice system isn't going to work in the absence of that. So, yes, we've seen reforms and changes. I think we've also seen new developments, too, in constitutional law.
Right.
And the way that, you know, you and I did things before, how those things have to be done now. And that's all good. And I think the closer look at things like conviction integrity, those are really important endeavors.
So I'm embarrassed to admit that I'm one of those people who thought when e-cigarettes were introduced that it was a good thing, that this is great. It's going to help people get off what I think some people are now calling combustible cigarettes, that it will help people who are trying to quit smoking, and nicotine isn't really that bad when you look at it, and boy, I could not have been wronger, right?
Well, you know, yes and no, okay? I think that I understand the argument for smoking cessation and e-cigarettes as a way to move people off of cigarettes into something that may be less harmful, but here's what we've seen, all right, and here's why this is a really big issue for my office and the focus of attention. What we've seen is companies like Juul come to market and essentially make it so appealing and target specifically to a younger demographic that we've seen, you know, vaping, Juuling, take hold in high schools, even middle schools around the state. This is like the number one issue I hear about from parents. Honestly, as I go around the state, this is the number one issue that parents are talking to me about. Can you do something? You know, my child is addicted. My child is currently being treated by a pediatrician for nicotine addiction.
And we're
they are suffering
this on the
in school. They're getting disciplined. They're getting kicked out.
Cigarette smoking decreasing. That's the other heartbreaking part of this. Yeah. We actually had seen progress in stopping teens and young people from smoking cigarettes.
Well, that's exactly right. And it's a shame to see all of that now threatened, but it's exactly why companies like Altria and others, formerly known as Philip Morris, have invested big time in this industry because they lost a whole class of consumers. What do? In the face of that, you go out and create a new group of consumers. And
well, it's the flavoring. It's
it's a couple things that are going on that, you know, again, adults can do what they want, right? But the concern that my office has is the real pervasive use. I'm talking about numbers like one school nurse reporting to me 80% of the kids in her high school are vaping, smoke alarms going off mm-hmm. in school bathrooms all the time because of this. I mentioned the number of reports I get. I sat in a middle school classroom not too long ago, and I asked for a show of hands from middle school students. These are 6th and 7th graders. Do you know anyone who vapes? In your peer group, do you know anyone who vapes? Every single hand went up in that classroom. And so this is a real issue. And here's how that, I think, developed, what our investigation into Juul and others has shown. These are companies that set out to really rip a page from Big Tobacco's playbook years ago, target through the use of cartoon characters, superheroes and the like, packaging that uses those cartoon characters or characters from pop culture that they really blast out through social media. And flavors, you're right, Andrew, that's a big deal. You know, cotton candy, bubble gum, you name it, gummy bear. There are flavors out there that are meant to appeal to a younger audience. And unfortunately, what I've seen happen, both kids and their parents think this stuff is harmless. It's just like water-flavored juice, kind of. And it's not, because it contains nicotine, and it contains nicotine in super high concentrations. One pod, it is the equivalent of a pack of cigarettes.
Which is 20, yeah.
And it's delivered in a really concentrated way. And nicotine may not be an issue for adults, okay, but for developing lungs and brain function, pediatricians will tell you nicotine is highly problematic. And we certainly see it playing out real time right now. We've gone after and shut down online retailers who are selling into the state to kids under age of 21, which is prohibited under law. We've continued to investigate. We sued Eon Smoke, a company out there, an e-cigarette company. We have an ongoing investigation into Juul. I am working with AGs from around the country on this issue because it's happening nationally. Education, prevention, you know, spreading the word to parents in particular, this is an issue, even though they probably know it's an issue, but also that there's resources available. And the sooner you can talk to your pediatrician or healthcare provider, the better, and make sure your kids have the awareness and get access to resources.
You know, what kind of person do you have to be, right, in order to run a... I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm just acting like Jim.
I'm giving... I know. She's, right. It's actually, in some ways, it's worse because you're a woman. Shame on you. I was going to say, I'm struck by how easy it is to draw in the youth market with the simple fact of newness. So all of the anti-smoking efforts over the years made smoking uncool for kids. Kids stopped seeing it as something that they wanted to do, versus when I was a kid, you could go to the store and you could buy candy cigarettes. They came in a pack looked exactly like your parents' cigarettes, and they were candy, but you would mimic smoking. And as a result, many of us smoked, right? Our parents smoked. We got candy cigarettes. We smoked because it was cool looking. Vaping is done not with a traditional cigarette, right? You have a vape pen or you have some other mechanism to do it. To the eyes of a younger person, it looks cooler, and the flavor. So it's really, at the end of the day, I think what I'm trying to say is it always comes down to marketing. It comes down to making a slicker-looking mechanism and marketing that. And your market literally beats a path to your door. And that's how easy it is to build back what Philip Morris lost.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. It's just, and there's no, until it's regulated, there's no conscience around it, because the free market being the free market. And until an AG or a bunch of AGs step in, there's no real reason for them to regulate it.
Well, it was AGs who stepped in and took on Big Tobacco on 1 year ago, and I joined with many colleagues in taking this on as a major issue out of our offices. I also support the call for the banning of flavors, because we know it results in young people disproportionately using and vaping. And also, these things should be taxed. E-cigarettes should be taxed and treated like other tobacco.
They're not.
Pack of cigarettes in the state of Massachusetts, it's like $3.50 a pack. That's the tax. No tax for e-cigarettes. That should change now.
We have a caller, Maxine, who has a question regarding JUULs for the Attorney General. Maxine, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Maxine?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air with us.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm very interested to know why the Boston Globe takes a whole page ad from JUUL every single week, showing that they are, quote unquote, good corporate citizens by the things that they are doing that they should have done in the first place. So they're making it look like they're good corporate citizens, when in fact Altria owns 35% of the company and is just doing the cigarette playbook.
Yeah, I hear you, Maxine, and not only are they advertising in the Boston Globe, but, you know, they're advertising everywhere. Every morning I get Politico, and the digital version of Politico, and it's basically sponsored by JUUL, or it looks that way because JUUL is all over it. And, you know, that just, to me, Maxine, shows how much money this company is raking in, such that they can afford this blitz of advertising everywhere that is really under the guise of trying to make good on this, make good face on this, and make it seem like they're doing something. And, you know, it's just they're a little too late to the party, because with their launch of social media back in 2015, in our view and based on our investigation, they really created a huge market for this that now other third-party retailers and sellers and manufacturers are also benefiting from. But, you know, to me, obviously we're going to do our job, Maxine, on the enforcement side of things, but I think I've also been active about the kind of regulation that we need and the kinds of education and prevention measures that we need. Again, my concern is with young people, and you know, I understand adult use, and people want to engage in that, and I get that, but we also, what do you do in the context of this situation where it's completely blown up in the youth market? And how do you rein that in? And, you know, I welcome constructive participation on that front.
Thanks, Maxine, for calling.
And, Maxine, the short answer to your question is the Globe took the ad because it's ad revenue. And so, you know, you can basically take out a full-page ad for anything that isn't illegal or at least objectively too offensive. Mm-hmm. But that's really why they took the ad. But, you know, I have to agree with the AG. That's a corporate spin on what actually is happening. Attorney General Healy, I caught you on MSNBC. I happened to come home and turn on Chris Hayes the other night. and you were on talking about this, the fight in the federal courts with you and a bunch of AGs from around the country on this lawsuit, again trying to get Obamacare declared unconstitutional. And as I sat there and listened to you, and I forget who the other guest was, but he was very good as well, I sat and listened to the both of you, and I thought, this is an on-its-face, ridiculous argument that the federal government is making. Why is this case still going on?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It's a shame that this has become a political issue. And what happened here? Let's just, you know, review the history here. ACA was passed. It was challenged. The Supreme Court ruled it constitutional. It's been implemented across the country, or at least in many places, and resulted in millions more Americans having access to health care. Congress, of course, prior to the midterms, attempted no less than 70 times to repeal the ACA. They failed. Why? Because the American people took to town halls and elsewhere to say, no, don't take away our health care. So what happens in the wake of that? A group of Republican AGs sued to challenge the constitutionality of the ACA under really what we think is a harebrained legal theory. Unfortunately, they had a good draw for a judge in Texas, and it was ruled unconstitutional. It's now on appeal to the Fifth Circuit. My office is actively, we intervened immediately, and we are defending the ACA. We will continue to defend the ACA because this is a matter of making sure that people have access to health care. And, you know, I met a woman just a few weeks ago who has a son with a congenital heart defect. He's had three major open heart surgeries. Because of the ACA, she doesn't have to worry about what's going to happen to him later because he's got a pre-existing condition and whether or not he's going to be insurable, you know, as he gets older. And that's something that no parent should have to worry about. There are more than 130 million Americans, including 2.5 million right here in Massachusetts, who have pre-existing conditions. There are over 300,000 Massachusetts residents and millions more around this country who, through the ACA, have access now to health care through Medicaid expansion. And, you know, we're talking about kids who are now covered up through the age of 26 on their parents' plan, women getting access to quality, affordable care. Health care should be a right in this country. It makes sense as a matter of, you know, the care that we should have for one another, also as a matter of economic imperative. It is really stupid that we don't find ways to take care of people at the outset and still wait for them to get super sick, show up in ERs, you know. Everything goes up in terms of the rates and the money that we're out and the money that states pay. So we're going to continue to be active. Ultimately, this case is going to go to the Supreme Court, all right? And we will be there all the way through the Supreme Court making sure that we stand up and defend people's access to health care in this country.
Just so that people understand how this happened, too. So back in a 2012 decision on the ACA, when it was declared constitutional, Chief Justice John Roberts said that the mandate, the fact that you have to pay a penalty if you're not enrolled, that that could be considered a tax on the public. Congress finally figured out that the constant sort of law, trying to pass laws to repeal it, didn't work. So what they were going to do was not fund the enforcement part of the mandate. They wiped out the funding. So you could not pay, and there would be no consequences. Then they turned around and basically said, this is an unfunded mandate. Mm-hmm. It's unconstitutional. There's no mechanism to enforce it, yet you're telling people they have to pay. That's what I meant when I said it was a ridiculous, on-its-face argument that went before, like you said, they got a good draw for a judge, and he declared it unconstitutional. I worry a little that it's going up to the Supreme Court because it's a different Supreme Court.
I worry a lot. You know, I worry a lot, and hopefully we'll get the Supreme Court the Fifth Circuit will reverse, but if they don't, hopefully the Supreme Court will. You know, this is about saving lives. This is fundamentally about saving lives, and the studies will show people will die if this goes away, and there is no reason for it. What this is about, these are Republican AGs who are basically just making a political political play. That's all. They don't like things that President Obama did. They want to stick it to him, stick it to the administration at the expense of people in their own states. And that, to me, is what is so shameful. As you look across some of these states, there are people who are suffering, who are dying, who don't have access to care in the states of Texas, in Louisiana, and elsewhere. And they are hurting their own residents. We've got a good law here on the books, which will continue to live on, and we have, as a state, bipartisan, by the way, found a way to ensure that people have access to health care. 98% of the people in our state have access to health care coverage. We pioneered universal health care coverage, and that's what makes sense as a matter of actions nationwide. So I get really burned about this and fired up, because it's just, to me, shameful that people in public office would put politics to this degree. I understand you're always playing politics, but to put politics to this degree for no other end and at the expense of lives in their own states is really, really shameful.
All right, Attorney General Maura Healey, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate you coming in. Good
that
to see you.
That went quick.
Very quick. You know, all very right. quick.
It was good to see you.
I wish everyone a good summer, and let us know how we can help.
Absolutely. All right. Every month, it's Ask the AG. Thanks for coming up. Up next, legal analyst Michael Zeldin is here to preview Mueller's testimony. A round of applause for AG. This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studios at Boston Public Library.
This is Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. The Mueller investigation has spun out like a Law & Order TV franchise. First, we had Mueller, 2 years in investigation, then the offshoot Mueller, the Mueller report, and now the much-anticipated spinoff, Mueller, Private Citizen, Public Testimony. William Barr says it will be a spectacle. But what about the substance? Joining us for a preview and what Congress is aiming to learn beyond Mueller's 400-page report is Michael Zeldin. He's a former colleague of Robert Mueller and a legal analyst for CNN. Michael Zeldin, welcome back to Boston Public Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, Michael. So what should be the biggest takeaways when the dust settles after the Mueller testimony? What do you think the Democrats want to be able to walk away with?
They want to be able to walk away with Mueller having informed the American public about what he wrote in his report. The assumption is that no one has read this book, and so now they're turning to the movie version of it, and they're hoping that people will watch the movie, and having watched the movie, they will have an aha moment to realize what they believe, which was that the president was willing to collude with Russia, even if he didn't conspire with them, and that he endeavored to obstruct the investigation, even if he wasn't successful.
So, Michael, you're making two basic points about this, and I want to get into both of those. I agree with you completely on both of them. But before we get to that, how pleased or disappointed do you think people are going to be in the movie? Is it going to be a movie? I think that's probably a better fundamental question in terms of Mueller's testimony. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, it will be a movie. The question is, how will the narrator of that movie perform? And that's all up to Bob Mueller. He can be very cryptic, yes, no, thank you, no thank you type of answers person, or he can be a little bit more full-throated. If he elects to be the person who tells the story in a narrative, coherent form, it's almost in the way that Ken Starr testified in the Bill Clinton case before Congress, then we'll get a very clear picture of what I think is between the lines of the report in that Mueller wrote, which is that he believed that the president could not be exonerated from criminal wrongdoing.
So I've had the opportunity to actually watch some of the Robert Mueller's former testimony over the years. And I'm struck by the sort of idea that there might be a Mueller that will string together a narrative. I didn't watch it from A to Z, but I haven't really seen that Robert Mueller testify. I've seen someone who will repeat what's in his findings, will repeat what's in his investigation, but doesn't offer a lot of clarity. Does that Mueller really exist?
It depends on the questioner. So if the questioner says, Can you please walk us through, using the language of your report, what it is that you found with respect to, hypothetically, the president's conversations with Don McGahn, White House counsel, with respect to his desire to have Mueller removed? Mueller then could, you know, theoretically say, as I wrote in my report, and then read through the report without the footnotes, and that would be a good narrative for the American people to gain an understanding of what Mueller found. If he is asked questions that say, did this happen, did that happen, then you'll just get yes and no answers, and it will be pretty disappointing for the American public who hasn't read the book, as I was saying.
And I worry about that a little bit, just because I've always thought, especially when the stakes are very high, and I'm always amazed it's disappointing that members of Congress don't yield their time to the best questioners among them. Now, that would obviously mean that only certain people were getting airtime on CNN and on C-SPAN and other nightly news shows. But I worry that people are going to be too wrapped up in the drama around them asking the question that they won't hew to what you just said, which is giving Mueller a chance to be as clear and as narrative as he possibly can be. What do you think about what might play out in this testimony?
Right. So as a matter of format, I agree with you completely that 5 minutes of questioning, one by a Democrat, followed by a Republican, then a Democrat, makes no sense. It's an incoherent way to extract testimony from a witness. And it also is incoherent to have, I think, different members asking different questions. I think that the better protocol would be if counsel to the committee on each side had a full uninterrupted period of time to start the questioning, and then after that is all done, they can go to the few select members who they designate to represent the committee to ask their follow-up questions. But we'll never see that happen because of what you said. The 5 minutes on TV is much more important than anything else.
What a nice little story that would be. What a nice little fantasy, just to actually have people questioning based on the validity of the question and not on speechifying.
But it's
outrageous.
Right.
And remember, can I just add one thing? Remember, yeah, we saw that in the Kavanaugh hearings, yeah, where the Republicans hired a lawyer who was to do the questioning on behalf of the Republican senators. But again, as she said, this 5 minutes on and off is just an incoherent way of proceeding. And then ultimately, of course, the Senator Lindsey Graham said, enough of this special counsel asking questions. I'm going to ask my own questions. And the whole thing collapsed into what it was.
Yeah, I don't get it. If the stakes are this high, to not be able to sacrifice your 2 or 3 seconds, that's what it will amount to, of airtime, for the greater purpose of getting this story out, when that's what the Congress is professing to care about. They're in the majority in the House. I assume they could alter these rules or configure it in a way that is best suited to this. It's a mystery to me why they're not doing it.
Well, remember, they wanted to do this with the Attorney General when he was going to testify at one point. They said that he was going to be questioned by counsel, and he refused to come, and the whole thing broke down. So it's on both sides. The witness and the members have to reach agreement that what is important most is for the American people to understand what happened so they can make an informed judgment about the events and how to proceed with that information. But that's a reality that doesn't exist.
The other tactic, too, of course, is attacking the messenger, where the Republicans might take a tack where they are questioning Mueller's staff, questioning his abilities, and that's something that could really backfire, right?
Well, I think that Mueller will take offense at being called a partisan or having put together a team of 13 angry Democrats, as the president likes to call them. Now, there are things that Mueller could have done better that he may have been a little bit tone deaf to in the composition of his team. He might have wanted to make sure that he had nobody on his team who could be attacked in that way, but I think that Bob will take offense at being accused of wrongdoing that is, you know, sort of ethical, moral in nature. And I think you may see a combative Mueller if he's attacked that way, and that could, you know, redound to the detriment of the questioner.
You referenced a couple of minutes ago that it was the negotiation was sort of on the side. It came from both sides, both Congress negotiating the terms and the format of the questioning, but also the witness negotiating that too, which I'd like to discuss Jonathan Urofsky a little bit. So this is a 70-year-old lawyer. He's a partner at WilmerHale, which is Mueller's old law firm. And he's actually been retained by Mueller and it has been counseling Mueller, getting him to the point of appearing before Congress. And so there are a couple of things with this that sort of puzzle me. First, couldn't Congress have simply subpoenaed Bob Mueller and demanded that he be there on a certain day and give testimony? And they didn't do that. And if you have a sense of why they didn't do that, I'd like to hear that. But also the fact that the scope and the format of his testimony is even the topic of a negotiation that involves another lawyer. I'd like you to speak to that a little bit.
So I think that Mueller made it clear that he did not want to testify, and he was told that he would be subpoenaed to testify if he refused. And so, in effect, he's appearing by subpoena or threat of subpoena. With respect to the parameters of what he's going to testify to, we saw yesterday that there was a letter exchange between Mueller and the Justice Department about the scope of what he could testify to, where the Justice Department reminded him to not talk about things that violate DOJ policy, such as talking about unindicted persons or sources and methods of proceeding or ongoing investigations. And then they added at the end that the executive branch has not waived privilege with respect to certain witnesses and certain topics by those witnesses, and to please honor the executive privilege so that it can be asserted if necessary. I think that's all appropriate. With respect to Mueller being, you know, sort of counseled by somebody else, legally counseled, you know, he's now a private citizen, and like everybody else, he's entitled to representation, and if he feels that that would be helpful to him to make sure that he's testifying in a manner that's consistent with what he wants to testify to and consistent with what Congress's needs are, then I don't think there's anything inappropriate about that either.
But if he's a private citizen, then how is he bound by all of these sort of, you know, I call them the don't you dare tell strictures from the DOJ? I mean, put aside for a second the fact that he is coming in to testify because we couldn't rely on Bill Barr to appropriately characterize his report or give us the executive summaries or even talk about the executive summaries coherently and without being misleading. Now they're basically saying to him, you don't work here anymore, but here are all the privileges, real and imaginary, because they've been asserting these imaginary privileges before Congress with other witnesses, that we would like you to honor. He doesn't have to do that, does he?
No, I suppose as a private citizen, he can do what he wants to do, though as a DOJ employee, former DOJ employee, I think he should honor the tradition of the Department of Justice, which is to not talk about privacy-protected matters or sources and methods or ongoing investigations. I also think he should allow the president to assert executive privilege as to those areas that there was no previous waiver as to. So I don't think that that's inappropriate. And I'm hopeful that we'll learn something from this and that it won't just be, you know, further obfuscation by another witness or false assertion of privilege when that privilege in part has been waived.
So can I just drill down on one further thing on this? So the part of the letter where they ask him not to talk about uncharged conduct or conduct related to uncharged individuals, that isn't that the point in large measure beyond the Russian interference of the election? Isn't that really the reason that he's being called in to testify, is that the president was the topic of this investigation? If he can't talk about conduct that was not charged because of a DOJ memo, what else is there for him? I mean, there was a lot for him to talk about, but I'm just bewildered as to how that he abides by that, given what this report is about.
Yeah, and I don't know that I agree that that's what this is about. I think that the uncharged people may be not the president or people mentioned so directly in the report, but others about whom we don't know, who may have been witnesses before him. Remember, he subpoenaed a boatload of people, not all of whom are known to us, and who he may have evaluated their behavior in respect of criminal or non-criminal. And if he determined that those were non-criminal actors, but they're unknown to us, then he shouldn't be talking about them. The notion is that if you are uncharged, you should remain uncharged and anonymous. With respect to the president, I believe that Mueller can fully speak to that which is in his report with respect to the behavior of the president. Though the president was not charged because of the reasons that Mueller set forth, the OLC opinion, fairness, basic fairness, and the limitations that he felt that the evidence presented, I think Mueller is fully able to speak all about that without any constraints by the Justice Department.
We're talking with Michael Zeldin, who's a legal analyst for CNN. Michael, my sort of bottom rung of what I hope the American public takes away from Mueller's testimony is exactly how much Russia interfered in the election and have a reaction about making some protections to try and stop Russia and anybody else from interfering in future elections. Is that a pie in the sky hope on my front, or can we expect that some of the testimony will actually be about that and the American public will react to that?
I don't think it's fanciful at all. And indeed, the way the hearing is structured is that in the morning, Mueller will testify from about, I think, 8:30 to 11:30 before the House Judiciary Committee. And the House Judiciary Committee will focus on Volume 2 of the Mueller report, which is the obstruction of justice findings. After a short lunch break, they will reconvene before the House Intelligence Committee, and the House Intelligence Committee will focus on Volume 1, which is the Russian interference. If you remember the 10-minute press conference that Mueller held where he said, this is what my findings are and I don't want to speak again, although he is obviously speaking again, he ended that 10-minute statement by saying there were substantial actions taken by foreign intelligence services to interfere with our election, and it's important that we focus on that. So I think he'll, in his testimony before House Intelligence, be much more willing to talk about the nature of the social media campaign and the hacking campaign that he uncovered in his investigation, the indictments that he returned against Russian individuals and organizations, and his hopes for what could be taken in the future to prevent it. So I think in that area, we may get much more fulsome testimony by Mueller than in the obstruction of justice area.
So, Michael, you have these sort of, you posit two ways or two areas of focus for the Democrats to proceed, and you think that this was likely to be the shortest distance between the public, the information that's available, and the public getting a grasp on it. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about those. One is about the Trump campaign's willingness to assist Russia, regardless of whether you call it, it meets the legal definition of conspiracy, or you call it collusion. And the second is the obstruction aspect. And can you explain to our listeners how you think the Democrats should go about this and how clear they should be about this?
Correct. So my view is that if I were a Democrat lawyer on the committee or a member on the Democrat side of the aisle, what I want to be able to do is make, if you will, a closing argument to America about what Mueller found. And in respect of the Volume 1 conspiracy stuff, I want to be able to say, yes, it's true that Bob Mueller didn't find a technical legal conspiracy, a meeting of two minds and acts in furtherance of that agreement, but I did find a campaign that was very willing, openly willing, and encouraging of interference to their advantage in our electoral process. And while maybe that's not criminal, maybe it should be criminal, but maybe because it's not criminal, it is unethical, immoral, unbefitting the President of the United States or, you know, candidate Trump for the 2020 election. So that would be sort of the closing argument I'd want to make. This guy, even though he was not found to have been a conspirator, he was a willing colluder in a lay sense, willing to, Russia, if you're listening, please find the Hillary Clinton emails type of colluder. That would be the argument I'd want to make on volume one. On volume two, what I'd want to be able to say is, even though the obstruction of justice efforts failed, that is, McGahn didn't listen to him, Corin Lewandowski didn't listen to him, Rob Porter didn't listen to him when they were each told to fire Mueller or to capitate the investigation in some way, the president's conduct was an endeavor to obstruct the investigation, and we should understand what the president was willing to do to protect himself from Mueller's watchful eye. And that's the sort of argument that I'd want to be able to make to the American public, and so I would want to ask Mueller just enough for him to elicit information for me to make that closing argument to America. This man, again, from a Democrat standpoint, I'm not saying this is my point of view, but from a Democrat standpoint, this man was a willing sort of cooperator with Russia and was doing everything in his power to end the investigation, even though he was unsuccessful.
Do you think there'll be a clearer marching order regarding impeachment to the Democrats at the close of the testimony? I mean, from my view, it was a clear message from the Mueller report, but now that we're going to see the movie, do you think when it comes to Friday or Monday or Tuesday, the Democrats will have clearly gotten the message and the public will get the message about what Robert Mueller's handoff of this report to Congress, what the impact of that will be?
It depends on how Mueller's testimony flows. If it flows along the lines that we've just talked about, you know, the Democrats' wishful thinking, then sure, that could tilt the needle further in the direction of impeachment, opening an impeachment inquiry. If, however, the Republicans are smart and they, too, go through the evidence, they will be able to say, because the evidence is in Mueller's report, that he did not commit a crime and that he was unsuccessful in obstructing justice. After all, he could have fired Mueller, according to their thinking. He could have fired McGahn. He could have done other things, which in the end he never did do. So there was a lot of, you know, chest pounding, but in the end, the president didn't do that which would have perhaps been obstructive behavior. And so if the Republicans focus on that, they may have a narrative that says no conspiracy, no obstruction. We've seen this movie now enough. Let's move on. If they focus on collateral matters, the emails between the FBI Strzok and Page, FISA warrants against Carter Page, the investigation of the investigators, I think they lose an opportunity to be able to make what is the counterargument to the Democrats, which was that there was no conspiracy and there was no obstruction, and we're wasting our time and let's move forward onto other substantive issues. So they each have opportunity here. Mueller is important to them in allowing them to make their narrative. We'll just see how they, you know, decide to use Mueller as their sort of tool for making their argument to the American people.
We're talking to CNN legal analyst Michael Zeldin. So, Michael, the news broke yesterday that the Republicans were sort of meeting as a team in preparation, which is apparently unusual. Usually individual members of Congress sit with their staff. They have their 5 minutes of questions, and they sort of work internally to develop that. But that Republicans had met all together and had done a mock Mueller testimony meeting. They were actually, people were role-playing the different roles and asking the questions. And then it also came out that that Democrats were planning on doing the same thing. In your experience, have you ever seen that happen before, where there's sort of a group effort to approach a single witness's testimony. There was one Republican member of Congress that said that he saw his goal as to get, in the context of this hearing, to get Donald Trump reelected. Have you ever seen this sort of team behavior for a single witness coming before Congress before?
Well, let's say first that I think it's not a bad idea that members on each side of the aisle coordinate their approach to the witness so that we get a coherent narrative instead of these five-minute one-offs that are inconsistent with one another and doesn't, you know, allow us to learn anything. But with respect to the question you're asking of have I seen this before, I believe that in the preparation for Ken Starr as a witness before Congress in the Bill Clinton impeachment inquiry, that the members on the Democratic side of the House Judiciary Committee did in fact meet regularly in order to coordinate their approach to the testimony of Starr and, if you will, apportioned aspects of it to various members to take it coherently. So I, in my lifetime, I think Lewinsky is the closest analogy to what we have here, but I think actually if the effort here is to educate the American people about what Mueller found, you would hope that each side would coordinate among the members so that we get, you know, a singular narrative rather than these five-minute CNN moments for rebroadcast in their districts and Mike, in their individual reelection efforts.
Michael, we also have social media now to a degree that didn't exist. It seems like every week we have more opportunities for folks to weigh in and give an opinion on things before they've even had an opportunity to settle. Do you look at social media as sort of the other adjudicator here, that Bob Mueller's up testifying, you've got the general public, you've got the lawmakers, you've got everybody else, and then there's this wild card of how social media reacts to what's happening?
Well, I have to say, by way of transparency, that I don't use social media. I don't tweet or Instagram. I have an old Facebook page that I think one of my kids set up, and I occasionally will post a picture at a bar mitzvah or something.
But do people
I'm not really an expert on social media. But seriously, to your question, yes, the court of public opinion matters greatly, and the manner in which people exercise their deliberative processes about what facts they're hearing is through social media. So I think monitoring how the testimony is playing out on social media will be an important indicator for Congress on how it should proceed.
So I'm also concerned that, you know, people have been comparing sort of the way Ken Starr proceeded, like immediately upon the conclusion of the report, he had so many copies delivered to Congress. He then, you know, did his own press conference and sort of made it very clear. And lots of people have been contrasting what happened with Ken Starr with what with Mueller's approach and with Barr's sort of intercession. Can you just explain and distinguish for people the difference between Ken Starr's role and Robert Mueller's role, but also where you think Bill Barr has interfered, if at all, but interfered too much?
Right. So Ken Starr was an independent counsel acting under the independent counsel statute. It was a statute that was passed. It was allowed to expire in the 1990s. But Ken Starr was acting as an independent counsel under a statute that required him to notify Congress of any acts that he came across in his investigation that he thought were worthy of impeachment consideration. So he was under an affirmative mandate to notify Congress of his findings. After that special counsel, after that independent counsel statute lapsed, they passed special counsel regulations to make sure that there wasn't a Ken Starr-like presentation again. So the special counsel regulations, which govern Mueller, were passed in direct reaction to the independent counsel statute that Starr operated under. Under the special counsel regulations, Mueller was not free to make a referral to Congress of an impeachable offense or anything of the sort. All he was allowed to do was issue a confidential report to the Attorney General, who then had all the power to determine whether it or some portion of it should be released to Congress or the American public. So we had two very different statutes. I wrote an article for CNN.com saying bring back the independent counsel statute. I think it was a better mechanism. There's improvements that could have been made for sure, but I think it was better than what we have now. But that's essentially the difference between the two. Because Mueller had to submit this confidential report to Barr, and then Barr had the freedom to submit it to the American public or to Congress, Barr, in a sense, was free to make it his own to the extent that he wanted to, and that's, in fact, what he did. He redacted it in ways that he thought were consistent with DOJ policy, and he forwarded it to Congress and the American people that way. And I think, though mistakenly on his part, he issued what he thought were the basic findings of the Mueller report, a summary, if you will, and those seem to be inconsistent with some of the things that Mueller wrote in his report. And it is that, I think, that led Mueller to write Barr a letter that's saying, you didn't summarize my findings appropriately, and that set up some sort of back and forth between Mueller and Barr.
Well, we shall see. Michael Zeldin, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll talk with you again soon. Michael Zeldin is a former colleague of Robert Mueller and a legal analyst for CNN. Coming up, hard to believe, 50 years ago, Apollo 11. What are astronauts eating? Food writer Corby Kummer joins us for that and more. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
This is Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us now to go over the latest stories about food culture, food policy, is Corby Kummer. He is the executive director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute. He's also senior editor at The Atlantic and a senior lecturer at the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science, and Policy. Hey, Corby.
Hello there. How are you?
Good to hear you. Good to see you. So I have been totally fascinated by this article in the
New
York
Times.
I'm obsessed. I was obsessed when it was published. I was obsessed when I knew you were going to be on the show. Andy Newman spent, I think, 6 days, he's a New York Times reporter, delivering food as a driver for, you know, a freelance driver for all the apps that we use to deliver our food, some of us. And what he has delivered in the Times is a snapshot of where we are as a society in so many ways. What did Andy Newman do and what did he tell us?
Well, first of all, he's the longtime editor of the Metro section of the Times, so he really knows New York. But then he found, when he got on a bike and worked for DoorDash, that he couldn't find his way around the financial district, which is impossible to find your way around. He kept losing deliveries because he accepted more than he could actually meet because it's so confusing to get around. But what he really found is the larger truth is delivery people are not treated as people by either the apps. These apps may be your friend when you want a cheese rose oolong tea delivered to your door in 10 minutes, but they are not the food service provider's friends, and they're definitely not the worker's friends.
Corby, there's a quote in here that he has from Wilder Selzer, who's a friend of his who's been delivering for 3 years, and according to Wilder, he said the job was a great window into our stratification. Quite a few times, he said, he has delivered to people, men and women alike, who answer the door in their underwear, but not in a sexy way. It goes back to the class thing. You're a eunuch. It's okay to be naked in front of you because you're not a person.
Well, okay, I was about to read that exact quote.
There you go.
Thank you for reading it for me. So what he found was class bifurcation. Here it is working with the people who come to your door. all of the young tech workers, and also what it's so, it's this dystopian view of what it's like to be in a luxury glass tower. So he took endless videos, and on the main story, we're both reading his kind of backstage account, which the Times also published, of what it was like to do this story, which is great. But also, they did this big multimedia extravaganza in which you see what it's like, the view from a bike trying to barrel between traffic in really scary situations. And one of the great quotes in the main story was a DoorDash worker who fell and broke both arms, and all DoorDash did was send him or her a get well card soon. Nothing about insurance, nothing about compensation, workman's comp. The whole thing was like this nightmarish, dehumanizing experience.
Okay, so I just want you to know, I need to reinforce this. I have been listening to Sue talk about this story since I came in this morning. As I said, she's obsessed with it. I read it and I thought to myself, on the one hand, I'm not at all surprised. What I've never been able to understand, because I'm one of those people that, you know, thanks whoever is serving me food or delivering me food, and I probably overtip because I recognize how much people rely on it.
Boy, are you the exception.
Well, that's what puzzles me, is it's not that difficult to be decent to people who are providing you a service. Why do you think, especially when it comes to the serving of food, the cooking of food, and the delivering of food, that people's worst instincts are indulged? Why do you think that happens, and happens so consistently?
Okay, let's ratchet it up to social isolation, which is considered the main health problem in society right now. Whenever you talk to people in public health nowadays, the buzz phrase is social determinants of health, which mostly has to do with housing and safety where they live, but it also has to do with social isolation. It is happening all over society, and it's a kind of dehumanizing that comes of only communicating with people on your cell phone via apps and not voice. And so I think that people aren't being treated as people. Also, you don't necessarily see them. You don't want to see them because you'll be reminded you might owe them something. But also, another nefarious, terrible, dehumanizing thing about this is the apps greedily steal your tip. So the person might think that, you know, like Andrea Cabral, they are being a model and tipping well. But I can't remember if it's on Seamless or Grubhub. They apply that tip toward the cost of their delivery, and they don't pass it on to the deliverer. They just give the deliverer the guaranteed minimum. And so one of the lessons is try to figure out or insist that the companies actually say whether the tips go to the workers, because often they don't. And Andrea, one thing I hope you read was a great piece in The Atlantic by Margaret Carlson, longtime Time columnist, TV commentator, whose grandmother was a maid, a hotel maid, and somehow got in cahoots with Claire Booth Lewis, a famous socialite, also an ambassador, to try to start a movement to tip hotel maids. You never see them. You never know how badly they're treated. And they're the ones who put up with the endless amount of mess you make, which, Andrea, you were asking, how is it about people's bad instincts? If you don't see them and don't look them in the eye, you don't have to feel guilty.
It's a perfect explanation for it, and there are several food delivery services that have cropped up, and I can't now think of which one it is, but there is one of them. It's either Grubhub or DoorDash. It might be Try Caviar. I'm not sure. That makes sure that you know. It says 100% of your tip goes to our delivery person, and the others don't say that. So I would suggest that if people really do care about this issue, that they check the website. And if they're giving 100% of the tip to the person who delivers, they're going to trumpet that, because it's not what the entire industry is doing.
It's part of the take home of this article. Yeah. So make sure the tip goes to the worker. Open the door. Look the person in the eye. Say thank you the way Andrea Cabral does by nature. But another thing is, think about where you order from and the way the restaurants are being treated, because Grubhub is doing this. I don't know if we're going to talk about this today, But they're stealing people's restaurant names to create phony websites to take away business from them and steal their commissions. Again, apps are not the friends of the businesses they serve.
Let's transition to that, Corby, that Chuck Schumer, New York senator, has called for a federal investigation into Grubhub. This might get a little in the weeds for folks, but basically some of these applications have made websites for restaurants, and I know back when I worked in the Boston at the Boston Phoenix in the early 90s, when websites were coming out, we would offer the service to restaurants that were not technically adept to make their own website. Grubhub has done some of this, but also is making an enormous amount of money, which I had no clue about, from phone call referrals between these websites and these phone systems, and it looks like lawmakers are again trying to catch up to technology.
So explain to people how it works, and then we'll get into the enforcement.
So again, I have to plug the New Food Economy, the website this came from, not only because I had a hand in launching it a while ago, but they're doing such groundbreaking investigative work. It's their investigative reporting. What do they investigate? That a small restaurant owner, they were able to quote, but not my name, she was afraid of losing business, discovered that Grubhub had started a website that was with almost the identical name to her restaurant. They'd added like two words to it. And so that's what they put on the Grubhub site. So if you went on to the restaurant's menu site on the restaurant site and you ordered something, Grubhub would get a commission. The restaurant would not. And in fact, whenever Grubhub gets a customer at the restaurant, in the fine print, the restaurant agrees to let Grubhub set up a website with its own name. And Grubhub tries to defend itself by saying, we're going to bring attention. We're going to bring them more business. This is good for business. But in fact, what they're doing is stealing a bunch of commissions, and they're like parking these names in a very unsavory business-robbing way to Grubhub, because the more orders you get, the more Grubhub charges you for these phony or maybe not phony promotion costs. They're promoting you. And when I did a piece on these on Seamless and Grubhub for the New Republic about a year and a half ago, what I got small business owners to say was that they felt that they were being bilked, and it was so hard that the more business they got out of Grubhub and Seamless, the more they had to pay them every month. And so their profit margins kept going down, even if their orders went up. And it was because these websites say it's this deal with the devil. We'll give you business, but we're going to take all your profit margin, and you're eventually not going to be able to survive.
I wish we were on TV right now so you could see Andrea Cabral's face.
No, I'm just thinking, you know, I do call, I will freely admit that I have called Grubhub to deliver food. And now, given this story, I find it really hard to believe that Grubhub is the website that says it gives 100% of the tips to the delivery person. I feel actually pretty comfortable saying that it is not them. But also, just the notion that this large a grift, like this kind of a scam, could go on and could go unnoticed for a very, very long time. As you said, now Congress is sort of trying to catch up. Not that there's not a bunch of things that they should probably be focusing on, but that they're currently trying to catch up to this. I mean, we're dealing with a lack of regulation or the decline of regulation just generally under the Trump administration, but these are the kinds of things that nobody ever or very few people focus on to regulate. And yet the amount of money, as you say, that Grubhub is making is enormous.
They said that they had there was a New York City Hall hearing, thanks to in part to this investigative reporting, in which company executives estimated Grubhub had made about $30 million just in phone commissions last year.
Just in the phone
commissions.
And
note that when you're on Grubhub and you call a restaurant, you are calling a number that's established by Grubhub. It's the same thing whenever you call an Uber or Lyft driver. You're not calling that driver's cell phone. Now, it's good for privacy, sure, but it's also so that all communications go through Uber and Lyft, and they get commissions on everything, and they're able to monitor every conversation. So I just love this Grubhub site. There's a woman who has Molly Hatchett's Subs Shop in Daytona Beach. She has her own website, mollyhatchettsubshop.com. Grubhub set one up that was, without her knowing it, that was Molly Hatchet's sub shop, DaytonaBeach.com.
That's amazing.
And, of course, anytime you try to order online, because Grubhub has such good search engine optimization, you're going to find their site, not hers.
And I guarantee people right now, you know, when you're searching and you get two menus right. And you go, what's up with this? And you usually go with the Grubhub one because it's the easiest one. So you have
it's easy in what they know.
Yep, they know. All right, let's look back in time. 50 years ago, Corby, Apollo 11, we've been celebrating it, the moon landing. And, of course, one of the things that I was raised was, you know, the Tang, the food that the astronauts ate while in space. And it is an actual important part of the science of food preparation, right?
Except you look back on Tang now and you think it's kind of like
crave it
orange
when I say
colored
Tang.
Sugar.
I still crave it yeah. if you say Tang.
Yeah, but it was very big. I mean,
still
they
crave
got,
it. That's the most yeah. interesting part of our conversation so far. What is it that you like about Tang?
Well, I don't know if I just vividly recall watching them land on the moon, and my mom was a big science geek in a certain way, and was so uh-huh. excited that we could have Tang. So I don't know that it was necessarily the Tang itself, but my mother's excitement in serving it that I was drinking what astronauts drank.
My mother said, absolutely not. Absolutely not. She didn't allow those kinds of things in the house because they had too much sugar in them, so she would say, eat an orange. And that was as close to Tang as we got.
But astronauts can't eat an orange, can they?
No.
So what are they eating in space?
So they can't have an orange because it's got too much liquid. And the key to food in space is draining out all the liquid. So freeze-dried technology, which I think came in, like, you know, most, almost every piece of important food processing technology was begun to feed soldiers. Canning was started in, like, the Napoleonic era as a revolution so that they could bring meat on military campaigns. Freeze-dried and meals ready to eat and TV dinners were entirely an outgrowth of the Second World War and the Korean War, in which there were these divided trays that we all think mm-hmm. of as nostalgia because they're TV mm-hmm. dinners. It was all leftover military equipment. So with space, it has freeze-dried implications because you have to remove liquid. You can't have any food spoilage in space, not only because it's practical and there's so little room, but if there's any food poisoning because of perishable food, you've got real trouble with your very expensive astronauts who are supposed to be doing, you know, the human part of intelligence on this. So my greatest disappointment in this really fun NPR survey of what is now eaten in space, the best part is freeze-dried shrimp cocktail. It supposedly reconstitutes and tastes a lot like shrimp. Who knew? Was that the freeze-dried ice cream now being marketed the way various people's mothers said, dang, how exciting, it's just what the astronauts have. So haven't you seen those little ice cream packages that say it's freeze-dried, it's shelf-stable, and it's what they eat in space?
No.
I missed that aisle.
Yeah.
Well, I have. It turns out they don't eat it in space.
Oh, so this is, well, it's a little puffery. We'll just call it puffery for that. I've always wondered about the quality, but the quality's gotten better as the technology's gotten better to provide food up there. None of it looks particularly appetizing to me, I have to say.
But when you read about it, it's like they eat stuff out of tubes and pouches. But the idea that when it goes into the spoon, the gravity at the bottom of the spoon is the same as it is at the top of the spoon, so it's really hard to manipulate any kind of cutlery, which is why they mostly suck things out of pouches and they eat it right out of the pouches. I mean, it's fascinating to think about what the implications are. Apparently, though, the thing that's been most exciting and innovative is being able to travel with bottles of sriracha hot sauce. Mm-hmm. That is what really excites the military, because, you know, whoever thought of this, but apparently nasal congestion is a big factor in space travel, and so you don't have as much taste. So you need the spicy shrimp cocktail sauce or the sriracha to make anything palatable. Can't have bread, and so tortillas are now the thing in space because you can wrap them up and they stay and they don't have much liquid in them at all. So it was full of these fascinating little tidbits about what they eat.
Corby, I love the fact that your segments are usually replete with stories like this. We can go from, you know, the temporary delivery guy getting food, being paid by people in their underwear, to people sucking food out of tubes and the excitement over sriracha.
Well, when you put it that way.
Well, and so we're going to, for our last little bit here, we're going to turn to a fairly, by your standards, somber story, but a positive one, in that the restaurant industry is actually looking to prisons to train and to find workers. And so there, I guess there was a $4.5 million grant to the National Restaurant Association, and it was going to go toward training inmates to master front of the house and kitchen skills, which is, A, there's apparently a dearth of jobs, but B, this is a really positive thing.
Well, I love this story, and I'm glad you said that because I was about to send the link to my pals at Community Servings mm-hmm. because it's a home-delivered meals program for people with critical illnesses. But for years we have had, thanks to our enterprising CEO David Waters, a job training program for returning citizens. Is that your preferred term, Andrea?
Yeah, so, you know, yeah, newly released individuals or people sort of reentering their communities, sure.
And it's all about food service because community servings, because it's serving many different kinds of medically tailored meals to ill people, has very rigid sanitary standards, you know, more rigid than most hotels and even more than hospitals. So going through this program equips workers to work in many kinds of food service industry, and it's become an incredibly inspirational part of community servings. But the idea that it is now catching on and that the National Restaurant Association, which takes stands that we won't go into here but are generally entirely protective of the industry, not necessarily worker-friendly, they have a philanthropy branch that is making this big investment in returning citizens training because they recognize this huge restaurant worker shortage, which I wrote a big story on for Boston Magazine, in which there's just people can't live here, they can't afford the expenses, but it is a seller's market entirely for restaurant food workers. National Restaurant Association recognized this, and they're funding this, which I think is an absolutely great thing.
We only have less than a minute left, Corby, but why is it that they're... Yeah, I think you just sort of alluded to it, but can you tell us a little bit more about why there's such a shortage and why people think that the reasons for the shortage won't apply to these prison workers who are now going to take these jobs?
Well, I don't know if these prison workers are going to be able to afford the rent. But just having – well, another big thing is immigration crackdown. Mm-hmm. So many places, including Dunkin' Donuts, are starting to sue and take away the franchisees' licenses unless they have ratcheted up their compliance policies with going on to government websites to see if it's I-9s, isn't it, if their workers have official permits to be in this country. And so the Trump administration crackdown on having official papers and work permits is scaring away a lot of people and driving away a lot of people. So there is this shortage. It needs to be addressed. But also, one of the main things that I hope the National Restaurant Association can address is, you know, restaurants have thought, oh, these workers are thieves and they're going to steal, whereas there's a huge success rate for people who've been trained in prison or just out of prison to be reliable workers so that they don't go back. And it's enormously important in preventing recidivism.
All right, Corby Cummer, thanks for joining us. I'm going to go find some Tang and cheer you, okay? Corby Cummer joins us every week. He's the Executive Director of the Food and Society Policy Program at the Aspen Institute, Senior Editor at The Atlantic, and a Senior Lecturer at Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition Science and Policy. Up next, CNN's John King joins us to go over the very latest in political headlines. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
This is Boston Public Radio, live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us on the line to take on the latest political headlines is CNN's chief national correspondent, John King. He's the anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch weekdays at noon and Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock. Hello, John King.
Hello. Happy Tuesday. Busy Tuesday.
Very. You think so? Let's go back in time, all the way back to Monday, yesterday, where it seems that Trump and has announced support for this two-year bipartisan budget deal. It's tentative. What do we know about it?
Number one, it's in some ways the death of the Tea Party. If you go back and remember when Obama was president, if you go back a little further and the big Tea Party wins in 2010 and 2014, what did they campaign on? They said Obama was a reckless liberal who was running up spending and running up the budget deficit. And they did, because we had divided government, a Republican House in those days, and then a Republican Senate after 2014. They did bring down the deficit some, and they did control spending some with the so-called sequester. The sequester's over. Big victory for Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in the House. The so-called sequester, which forced budget caps, is gone as part of this deal. Spending goes up. President Trump did not get anywhere near the restraints on spending, the cuts, the, you know, the counters, if you will, cuts, offsets. You already see members of the Freedom Caucus, other one-time fiscal conservatives in the Republican Party, saying they're going to vote against it. But on the plus side, it sets off any more fights about the debt ceiling until after the 2020 election. There's still a slight possibility of, you know, stalemates and a potential government shutdowns, because they actually have to pass the documents. This sets the spending levels. They still need to do some of the other work. It seems that you'll have some defections on the left. Liberals think it doesn't give them enough power, or it gives President Trump too much power. You'll have some on the right, but it seems like this will pass by the end of the week. But keep an eye on it. When the president sees some of his allies, like Jim Jordan, on Fox News beating it up, he's been known on occasion to back away from deals he's made.
Well, it's, you know, raising the spending limits by $320 billion on the heels of the increase in the deficit that's come as a direct result of the corporate tax cut, I'm not sure how any Republican, whoever, campaigned at least even once on fiscal conservatism and decreasing government spending could support this. I don't know how do you make that argument with a straight face?
Trump has changed the party. I mean, Trump has fundamentally changed the party in so many ways. The Republican Party used to be the free trade party. The Republican Party used to be, go back to George W. Bush, you know, let's give legal status or citizenship to the 11 million or so, you know, and be a program immigration party. The list goes on. Donald Trump has fundamentally changed the Republican Party in just a few years. And remember, candidate Donald Trump, I'm not saying anybody took him seriously when he said this because of his past history as essentially a New York liberal, if you will, or at least not a New York conservative. But he said he could balance the budget, it would be easy. And he even said that in 8 years, if you gave him two terms, he would erase the national debt, not the annual budget deficits, the huge national debt. That's not happening. Spending and deficits are going up. The rate of increases in spending and the rate of increases in the deficit are higher in the Trump years than they were in the second Obama term.
We're talking with John King from CNN. So Vice President Joe Biden, who's obviously a candidate for president, who's been known as a Mr. Tough on Crime Democrat, has released his criminal justice reform proposal. What's in it?
It's essentially a repudiation of a lot of the things then Senator Biden worked with the Clinton administration on in the 1994 crime bill. Now, at the time, to be fair to the former vice president, then senator, mayors were screaming for that. It was the days of the crack epidemic, and there was a crime epidemic, and there was a gun epidemic. And so a lot of the people criticizing those positions now, I mean, they don't remember the history. It was mayors and governors and a lot of community groups, housing groups, for example, in inner cities, talking about the crack and the gun epidemic, arguing for that crime bill. But it has become an albatross for Joe Biden because so much has changed in the last 25 years. So his new proposal gets rid of mandatory minimums. It gets rid of the private prison system, which is something Elizabeth Warren has talked about, and has a whole host of the more progressive reforms that progressives and other Democrats have been pushing in recent years. The question for me is, especially with round two of the debates next week, you know, Biden has got his past is hurting him. It makes him seem out of step with today's Democratic Party. Can he use this proposal to make the case, I get it? We did what we did at the time. He's going to defend it because he thinks at the time, again, they were listening to mayors and listening to governors and listening to the police. But can he, you know, just defend it quickly? He gets bogged down sometimes. I call it stubborn Irish. We know a little bit about that in Boston. You know, he gets bogged down sometimes in defending his past positions as opposed to making a quick defense and then pivoting, but here's where we are today. And can he use this to get out from under that? Can he use this to look forward and not in the rearview mirror at his past all the time? I think we'll see that in the debates. I can tell you already, Senator Cory Booker, has issued a really harsh statement saying, you know, you built this horrible system, we will dismantle it, essentially serving notice that he's going to go after Biden in the debate.
So University of New Hampshire Survey Center's CNN poll came out last week. We want to talk a little bit about Bernie Sanders. Apparently he's dropped, it shows him dropping 11 points among likely Democratic primary voters since April, which is, that's no small amount. And there's now talk that maybe, you know, because he's from Vermont, he's always considered to sort of have this, the insider's track for New Hampshire for that primary. There's a possibility that he may be, his firewall in New Hampshire may be faltering. Talk to us a little bit about that.
I think this is a fascinating dynamic. There's the national global dynamic of both Sanders and Biden coming down. The two older, the two male, the two more familiar candidates, if you will. Biden, obviously, from his career in the Senate and then as vice president. Sanders ran in 2016. He won New Hampshire in 2016, but it was a two-way race. Sanders is having an issue with this more crowded field generally, number one. And number two, the other candidate well-known in New Hampshire, he's from Vermont, Massachusetts, is Elizabeth Warren, is giving Sanders a serious run. She is ascendant in the race. She's a direct threat to him because of their shared progressive ideas and policies. And if you look closely at that poll, Sanders and Warren, by the way, we talked about the Biden factor of the debate. That's number two. Night number two on Wednesday, we'll have Biden in the middle with Harris and Booker on either side of him. I'm looking forward to that. But debate number one, the first night, Sanders and Warren are in the middle. Now, they are allies, if you will, and there are a number of moderates on that stage who are going to make the case you can't have Medicare for all, you can't do free college tuition, you can't do the Green New Deal, especially in one national election. There's no way we can sell that to the American people. You liberals are too far out there. So Warren and Sanders, I think, will be getting beat up on, so they'll be allies there. But look at that New Hampshire poll. They hold Sanders and Warren 40% of the vote between the two of them. They're also the top second choice for New Hampshire Democrats. So Warren and Sanders, maybe it won't happen in the debate. This is a fight that has to happen at some point.
John,
so they are in each other's way. Elizabeth Warren has emerged as a serious threat to Bernie Sanders.
It's amazing to me. I can't imagine what it must be like to be Senator Sanders, who in the last election was seen as this outlier who came up with these crazy fantasy ideas. And now almost all of the Democratic candidates have embraced at least some portion of it. And you would think that he would just be leading in the polls, you know, with the exception of Biden.
Well, I think you're right. From a policy perspective, at least the bulk of the Democratic field has moved his way. There's about a half and half on Medicare for All, or at least some of the provisions. How fast do you do it? What's the transition? Does private health insurance get completely eliminated, or do you do more of a public buy-in like Biden says? But there's no question the party has drifted his way, and so the question is, so why isn't he running away with it? Well, I do think, number one, he can be abrasive sometimes in his personality. Number two, he had a one-on-one race last time. It's a lot different in a one-on-one race. And I do think that every campaign is about new and different and change in the future. And you have this remarkable Democratic field. It's going to shrink after this first round of debates, and then it will shrink more after the debates in September. But you have, you know, more than 20 people running, including a lot of interesting candidates. That's not endorsing their positions, but you have, you know, a gay mayor who served in Afghanistan. You have an African-American senator from California. You have an African-American senator from New Jersey. You have Senator Warren. You have the other lesser-known candidates. So it's harder in a crowded field. And I do think there's a feeling in the party, and this is hurting both Sanders and Biden, that let's give these new people a look. Let's give the new guys a chance to keep an open mind.
We only have a couple of minutes left, John, but I agree with you, and I also think, I'm wondering, you know, what your position is on this, that his reaction to Warren's climb in the polls is sort of less, you know, to be kind, is less than generous. And so there's sort of this resentment that I think plays against him in terms of, you know, if you want to come in and you want to say, well, I had all of these ideas first, there's got to be a way to say that without actually saying, I had all these ideas first, who the hell are you to bring them up now? Because that's sort of how it's coming across.
Well, and she would argue, no, you didn't really. I was just, you know, either I was a professor or I wasn't in the Senate, but I had many of these views and I was talking about them. What he says is that I have proven that I can lead a movement. He says the polls show him running stronger against President Trump, and that's used to be true. I'm not sure it is anymore. Senator Warren's standing has come up too. Bernie might be a little bit stronger in those polls. But the line from him is that, you know, we're friends, but I have led a revolution and a movement, and I'm a stronger candidate in the general election. We'll see if he can keep that up because, again, she is a direct threat to him. And I just think that he's having a harder time in this campaign. She doesn't need to attack him. She's on the way up right now anyway. It's helping her, and I do think you see, look, the Democratic Party is, once you get past Iowa and New Hampshire, is a party where 60% of the voters are going to be women. A lot of the voters are going to be African American. And so you have these women, more diverse candidates, I think are getting an extra special look, and I think Sanders is having a hard time right now. Now,
and he always has. That's actually not new. Yeah. He historically has trouble with people of color, voters of color. Right.
Yes, he has. That was his undoing in 2016 when he was a much bigger threat to Hillary Clinton than most of us thought. The flip side, though, is his support is down, but he has a loyal base of support that gets him into the mid to high teens in just about every state, and he has a proven fundraising network. So if this is a long, drawn-out race, he has proven, and he proved against Hillary Clinton, that he's proud and he's stubborn and he'll stay in there and fight.
He also had to do some repair on his campaign on the ground, where it seems like Elizabeth Warren has just been staking flags across the country.
I don't think there's any question that she has built a good operation. She's really surprised people, too, because she's not doing the big fundraiser. She's doing this mostly grassroots, and a lot of people think she couldn't raise the money, and so far she's been able to.
All right, John King, thanks so much for joining us. John
Thank
King,
you, John.
CNN chief national correspondent and anchor of Inside Politics, which you can catch on Sunday mornings at 8 and weekdays at noon. Coming up, Procter & Gamble jumps into the women's national soccer team's equal pay debate. Sports Authority Trenny Kuznarek joins us. 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. We're live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
This is Boston Public Radio, broadcasting from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us now on the line to go over the latest stories at the intersection of sports and society is BPR contributor Trenny Kuznarek. She's a reporter and anchor for NBC Sports Boston. Hey, Trenny.
Hi, Sue. Hi, Andrea. How are you?
I am good.
We've been up all night worrying about this Eckersley-Price feud. I have to say, Andrea called me at 2 in the morning. She said, I can't sleep. This is the top of my mind. What the heck is happening with Boston Red Sox starter David Price and broadcaster, NESN broadcaster Dennis Eckersley? What the heck is happening?
So this started about 2 years ago. Eckersley, during a Red Sox broadcast, looked at the pitching line for Eduardo Rodriguez, who was doing a rehab start, and he just simply said, yuck, because it was so bad. And
that's his job, right? His job is to do those things, right?
Well, yes, Sue. Well pointed out. Yeah, it is his job. He said, yuck, and apparently David Price took exception to that. So he confronted Eckersley on the team plane and undressed him to the point where Eckersley wasn't quite sure how to respond, but it leaked out and everybody got the details. And so there was this feud between Dennis Eckersley and David Price. And this was when David Price had yet to win a World Series with the Red Sox. So, of course, everyone sided with Dennis Eckersley. Well, fast forward, this sort of gets pushed to the side. No apologies are exchanged, but they, can live civilly with one another. And then Chad Finn of the Boston Globe wrote a wonderful piece on Dennis Eckersley about everything that he's been through in his career, battling alcoholism and addiction and some mental health issues, a really nasty divorce. And, of course, during that, he asked him about his broadcasting career and some of the high and low moments. And the Price incident came up, and he just simply gave a pretty benign answer of, hey, no, we haven't talked, and I don't think we ever will talk, ever. I don't think either of us cares to. And that was it. Well, of course, it gets aggregated, and it gets pulled out, and it's tweeted out. Dennis Eckersley says, him and David Price will never speak, and David Price felt the need to respond to it. So first he tweets about it, but then, guys, he holds, a press conference before a game last week at Fenway Park and absolutely tears into Dennis Eckersley, saying that one day when his documentary airs on MLB Network, they're not going to have to interview him because he's going to have some teammates who want to talk about him, and no one would even talk about Eck, which, by the way, was factually incorrect. Eck is one of the most beloved former players in all of baseball. Anyone ever played with him. It's just childish and ridiculous, and acts like, you know what, I'm not going to deal with it anymore, and David Price just continues to act like a child.
And
then, by the way, he went out and got absolutely slaughtered in his first start afterwards, which I quite frankly enjoyed.
But there's a part, I absolutely agree with you, this is stupid, and it's childish, and it's nonsense. And actually, if the sports press stopped covering it, then we wouldn't be thinking about it anymore. I mean, there's two parts to this. There's the absolute idiocy of Price, who apparently his feelings, according to him, his feelings, I guess, are still hurt because he did make some overture a couple of years ago to sort of have a sit down with Eckersley and sort of let bygones be bygones. He claims that Eckersley didn't show up. I have no idea whether or not that's true, and I'm quite frankly, I don't care at all about it. But so there's that part of it, is there's the sense that this is childish and ridiculous. At least it seems from Eckersley's part, he's trying to step back from it, and Price, you know, just sort of keeps pressing forward. But then there's the other part that we cover it, so, you know, or media covers it, and thereby lets the feud continue to at least fester, if not actively continue.
What is sports without a feud? I mean, we need to have a feud, especially this season. We need some reason to care, right, Trini?
Yeah. There's not a whole lot to care about. They did win last night, but they dropped 2 of 3 over the weekend to the Orioles. So there's not a whole lot to love about this Red Sox team this year, but I would liken it to it. And I think people who don't work in sports, it is childish, but is it any more childish than us covering, you know, and I understand that he is the president of the United States when he starts silly feuds with other world leaders. But within the context of sports, David Price is a huge star. Dennis Eckersley is a huge star. And if two big political stars got into a tiff on Twitter, political media and national media would certainly cover it. So
but
it's really no different.
That's exactly my point. I don't think we should be covering any of it.
Well, I'm totally invested in it.
I don't think we should be feeding any
totally
of it.
I'm totally invested in it, Trini. So if you can get on the ground and get some more information, I'd appreciate it.
I mean,
I'm currently in northern Wisconsin, so that's not going to happen.
I will say I'm not completely, you know, blind to the needs of the places where sports and entertainment and culture and all those things intersect, and that this is something that, you know, people are talking about over the course of talking about, you know, millions of different things in their lives. But really, the reason I asked you the question is because my bigger point is that I think it's really having a terrible effect on all of us that we cover Taylor Swift's spats with people, and we cover David Price's spats, and we cover the fact that the president argues with everybody.
I was raised in a household in the 1970s that got a home subscription to Star Magazine and The Inquirer.
I cannot believe you're admitting that.
My mother would say to me every day when we'd get it, listen, it's not whether it's true or false, it's whether it's news. That's the issue. Oh. So we would read about Ted Danson's toupee. I'd feel more informed. I knew it wasn't news. But let's switch something to something more serious, Trini, which is...
Forgive her, Trini, for that.
That's okay. I do not... I will say this. I am with you, Andrea, on the sense that I will not buy, like, Us Magazine, Us Weekly, whatever it is, People. I don't read those things. However, in the middle of July when there's nothing going on...
There you go.
We said, thank the lucky stars, David Price, actually, because it helped us stack a 2-hour show in the middle of July.
There you go. All right, let's talk about something a little bit much more on the serious side, and that's the decision by NFL Commissioner Goodell regarding the Kansas City Chiefs wide receiver Tyreek Hill. Can you set the table a little bit for us, Trini, and just... What's happening in this Hill case? What's he being accused of, and what did Goodell do?
So Tyreek Hill was accused of physically abusing his 5-year-old son. As information came out, there were some conflicting reports, whether it was him, whether it was his wife that was the part of the abuse, if it was both of them. Tyreek Hill, however, is no stranger to physical abuse. The mother of this child, who I believe is now his wife and pregnant with another one of his children, or they just had another child together, in college, he shoved her down the stairs while she was pregnant with this child.
He has had domestic violence issues in the past. So this is not a one-off. This is a habitual pattern. But the NFL, after talking to Tyreek Hill and the wife, the mother of this child, refused to speak with Roger Goodell in the NFL. They just decided to say, you know what, we don't have enough information. Tyreek says that they did not really hurt the child, that it was just discipline. And it was the mother's fault, and it's not my fault. And he was convincing enough that they said, you know what, we don't see enough here to suspend you. It turns my stomach because I read a comment as I was looking at all the articles written. I saw someone say, yeah, he's not going to be suspended until we get pictures again or until there's a video. But what makes me the most upset is that once again, you know, someone who has been abused by this person before, in his now wife, then fiance, once again refuses to participate. To me, that should be a red flag. That should be a red flag of when the other parent refuses to participate to help exonerate her husband. That should be an indication that maybe we look more deeply into this. And I understand that the NFL is not, you know, they're not the legal system. There are no criminal charges in this case. But you're still supposed to hold your players to a high standard. And again, I thought Tom Brady deserved some sort of punishment, but I keep going back to Deflategate. I mean, it's this minor infraction, like, you know, equipment infraction. Tom Brady suspended 4 games. The Patriots have fined $1 million. Tyreek Hill has second, maybe third domestic abuse case against him, and he gets nothing at all. And it's not consistent either. We see it happen over and over and over again in the NFL, and I see this every single time we have this conversation. The NFL does not care about people. They care about their product. They don't care if you beat your wife unless there's video or pictures. They don't care if you beat the crap out of your kids. They don't care what you do. They don't care if you sexually assault people. If they cannot prove it, they will not punish you. They don't care about women, and I don't understand why women continue to consume this product, women continue to consume this product.
So, Trenny, I want to make a point about that, and I also thought when I read through this that there's two ways to sort of look at her not coming in to talk with the NFL. There's not coming in, to your point, not coming in to help exonerate him, which would, I think, would clearly have been part of the expectation. And also her not wanting to come in because she realized that the deck would be stacked against her. If she perceives that the purpose of the hearing is to exonerate him, then it has to lay the blame at the feet of someone else, and she'd be the only other person in the room.
True.
And we should also mention that this child's arm was broken.
Right.
Right. In addition to other injuries,
other injuries,
this child had
well.
His arm was broken. So whatever it is that Tyreek Hill went in and said to them, the injuries were very, very serious and could not and should not be explained away by accident. But the other part of this, I agree with you completely. Goodell's inconsistency, the general indifference of the NFL, especially to certain types of charges of misconduct with regard to players and their sort of the primacy of what each player is worth being the most important thing is part of it. And also Goodell's decision-making even within that is completely inconsistent player to player, team to team. And part of the problem, I think, is because the entire discretion lies with him. He is literally...
He's the beginning and the end.
The beginning
the
and the
judge,
end, an
the
audience
jury
of
and
one.
The police. Yep.
And you're not going to ever get a change in any of this until the decision-making or the findings and conclusions process rests with someone. He could be part of it, but rests with people other than him.
And it should be noted, and I can't remember her name right now, but there was a woman that they brought in that was supposed to sort of be a specialist.
And that's right.
Supposed to help. Build a program
oh, yeah.
in the NFL.
So
that
how'd that go? We can't even remember her name. That's
right.
How well that went.
We can't remember her name. And she also left because
yep.
she said it was clear to her that no matter what she proposed to the NFL in terms of punishment, education, really dealing with this at a root level to help not just, you know, punish guys.
But to prevent it.
To
help prevent it. Right.
Stop it before it begins. She said they didn't care. They never took anything she said seriously. She was there as window dressing and public relations and nothing more. And so I've made, you know, listen, I don't have a choice. I have to cover the NFL. I have to watch Patriots games. But I have made a choice that I will not play fantasy football this year. I don't really watch much football at all anymore outside of the Patriots. I don't even watch the Packers that much anymore, even though, you know, I grew up really.
Yeah, I've stopped watching except for.
I won't buy merchandise from
yep,
the NFL
except
anymore.
For the Super Bowl and if we get into the playoffs because I feel I have to
do it for work. Otherwise, I don't watch any football. I do wear an NFL cap that I got for free, but I wear it ironically.
She wears it ironically.
All right, we're talking to Trini Considerica. Let's switch gears again and talk about women's U.S. soccer pay, which we should talk about every week, I think, for the rest of our lives. You know, Trini, I've always remarked about how in the LGBTQ civil rights movement, it seems like the Fortune 500 companies and private industries were the first to sort of lead the way, like they offered domestic partnership benefits before the government required they do so. We're now looking at a situation where Procter & Gamble is stepping up to try and urge the equal pay for women in sports. What's happening?
So this is great. So Procter & Gamble basically told the U.S. Soccer Federation, do the right thing, be on the right side of history here. And to show you how committed we are to the U.S. Women's National Team, they pledged more than $500,000 and they deposited that into the team's fund. The exact number was very significant because it was $23,000 per person on the team for 23 people on the team. So they picked a number that each woman would get $23,000, which, by the way, I know to all of us, we would say, boy, I'd love an extra $23,000, but for what they've accomplished, they deserve far more. Mediation began this week on the equal pay discussion. But I don't know how the U.S. Soccer Federation cannot make the right decision here. And the right decision is to make sure that everything is equal, that, you know, the women get paid the same amount for appearances. They get the same amount for wins rather than getting less for a win than sometimes the men's team gets for a loss. FIFA is another conversation. I think that's what makes this soccer conversation difficult, is that there's the world level with FIFA and then there's the national level with U.S. soccer. But these women, you know, if you're going to talk about and say, well, it's dependent on advertising and it's dependent on interest, I will say, I there are many women's sports out there. We'll use the WNBA as an example. They do not draw the advertising dollars. They do not draw the numbers or merchandise, anything close to what the NBA does, even after being in existence for 20-plus years. But U.S. women's soccer is not – that's not the case. They generate a ton of interest, and they are a winning team. They are the most watched soccer team in the nation. So if your argument is that you should be paid commensurate to what you produce, they are – vastly outproducing the men, and that's to me where the equality should come in.
Well, how does management then come to the table with a straight face and make any argument in opposition or raise any issue in opposition to equal pay? Now, there is sort of a difference in historically what the teams have focused on, where the male teams tend to focus more on their bonuses, which are 10 times larger than the women's, and the women tend to focus on getting a guaranteed salary. But to me, that is merely an indication of how unequal things are.
Yes.
And the fact that the women are looking for stability and consistency in a sport that they're bringing so much to, and the men have the luxury of having that level of stability and consistency and can focus on their bonuses.
And what I would say is, however they want their payout to be, it should just be equal. If the women, because they can't earn, I mean, men, you know, they can earn, again, the soccer team, the NWSL, does not, you know, Major League Soccer at the MLS, you're not, by the way, you're not a $1 million athlete if you're like the 12th player on an MLS team. This isn't, I know that people, so you'll look at Gustavo Bow, who the Revolution just signed. You know, there was like a $16 million transfer fee. He's a seven-figure player, but that is an exception, not the rule in MLS. But they at least have, a lot of those men have the option to even go play overseas for Premier League teams or higher level soccer teams. Women don't have that opportunity.
Yeah, there's more opportunity.
Right, so if you value your women's soccer team and you value the fact that they consistently excel on the national stage, then all I think they want is, okay, if we choose to get paid by a salary because I can't make a salary somewhere else, let's just make sure that bonuses and salaries, however it is, at the end of the day, it's an equal amount of money.
Exactly.
Or, again, more for the women who deliver. Like, bonuses for the men shouldn't be more if they lose than if the women win. I mean, that's just not fair. Because what's the incentive to go out there and put together a good program and win?
And we're going to switch over to ESPN now, Jenny, where once
Speaking
again...
Speaking of unfair.
Once again, ESPN is finding themselves in the position where they are, according to The Hill, reportedly sent a memo to employees reminding them to avoid discussing politics in light of a talk show host, Dan Le Batard. Is that how you say his last name?
Dan Le Batard.
His criticism of Donald Trump. ESPN should probably pick a lane, don't you think?
Well, and the other thing about this is that sending out this memo pretends that there is never any political speech on ESPN.
Or in sports.
Right, or in sports generally. It's just insane. This is clearly directed at not angering the Trump administration.
Yes. That's exactly what I said, Andrew. I also said that I think where Dan Le Batard got himself in trouble is not only did he just talk about President Trump's extremely racist comments to tell four women of color to go back to their countries and then double down on that at a rally and try to lie, even though there's video showing that he did nothing to stop the chance of send her back. Dan Le Batard, who is, I think he is Cuban. So he's Latin American and is saying, listen, this happens to black and brown people all the time. This is racist. This is hurtful. Have you ever thought about what it's like to live in this country and have this kind of language be okay? You know, I think he probably still would have gotten in trouble had he just said that. But then he took it a step further and said, my company doesn't want me to talk about it. And he also took ESPN to task. I give him credit. Not a lot of people have the stature at a network to be able to publicly, you know, criticize them. I think Dan does probably have that. He was on the show yesterday because ESPN told him he wasn't allowed to talk about it or address the incident, so he took himself off of the show. But I just think, you know, ESPN has backed itself into a corner where their people can't even stand for what's right. And we have a policy at NBC. We are, you know, it's not like we're allowed to all just go rogue and say whatever we want, whenever we want, either on air or on social media. But they believe that as long as it's within taste and within good faith, you know, especially for speaking up for, you know, disenfranchised communities, whether it's LGBTQ or minority communities, you know, NBC isn't going to say, you know what, we prefer if you didn't stand up for your, you know, your black colleague or your lesbian colleague. They in fact, I wouldn't say encourage it, but they certainly don't discourage it. ESPN has created a culture where, and I know a lot of, I have a lot of friends who work there, who they will say nothing in the face of the worst things happening because they don't want to feel like they're not going to get their contract renewed. And well, to me, in this climate right now, that's just unfortunate. I know why ESPN does it because they're the few very right employees they have feel like it's a double standard, that when they speak their mind, they get in trouble.
Well, it is. There's clearly a double standard. People remember the incident with Jemele Hill. Mm-hmm. That's a clear example of it. But also, this is the kind what the president said, and what he then used his rally to stoke. People who are doing science, or who are talk show hosts doing science related topics, should be talking about this. It's not exclusive to sports. Anybody who can take to the airwaves as an American ought to be absolutely outraged by it and ought to be speaking up about it, not for their colleague who is black or brown necessarily, but for America, for the democracy, for the fact that what the president said is fundamentally wrong and racist. And so I get him calling out ESPN for cherry picking what they consider to be political and therefore unacceptable speech.
All right, Trini Kuznarek.
Yeah, good. I don't blame him at all.
Me either.
And I don't blame you. So you keep covering that Price Eckersley thing, okay? All right, Trini.
It was great to talk to you.
Thanks for joining us. BPR contributor Trini Kuznarek joins us every week here. She's an anchor and reporter at NBC Sports Boston. Look at another show, Andrea, with the dream team of Cam. We have come, we have conquered, we've done it all.
Solved the world's
problems. We've solved the world. Thanks to listening for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, of course, live coverage of the Mueller testimony starting at 8:30 a.m. right here on 89.7. Andrea, we'll see you again, you and me together. I can't wait.
Absolutely.
All right. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Our on-site engineer at the BPL is the amazing Ron Milton. Special thanks to all the folks over at the News Feed Cafe. Thanks for listening.